We're gonna skate to one song only.
This is
Editorial again.
recently Kobe Bryant has been on an extreme tear through the league, dropping 40. I think he had three consecutive games with 40 points. You know, after one of those games, you know, you're doing a post-game interview at the podium. He made the comment that, you know, earlier in the week a publication had ranked him the seventh best player in the league. You know, he dropped 40, and he felt the need in true Kobe style, in a way that only Kobe Bryant can. He felt slighted by that. And so in response, he came out and said that, you know, 40 points is not bad for the seventh best player in the league. You know, the Mamba's angry, all right? Somebody poked the Mamba, all right? And then Mamba went even further later in the week in another interview to say that there are only two other players who have the same competitive drive that he has. And he named Chris Paul and Derrick Rose, which is high praise for those two athletes. But I also think it's just as notable as who he left off. No LeBron, no D-Wade, no Dirk, you know, no KG, no Paul Pierce. He didn't name any of his rivals. So what do we begin to make of Kobe right now? Has the media kind of pushed him aside? Are we as a sports media, as a sports watching and a sports consuming mass, are we kind of pushing Kobe to the side a little too soon? I'm going to throw that one to D-Wills first.
You know, I was thinking about this. And it's kind of like when kids today try to elevate some of these young rappers, even though Jay-Z is killing them. You know, when I listen to Kobe's quote, Kobe's kind of like, KRS-One. You know how KRS said every year he writes a battle rap for the top 10? That's how Kobe is right now in his career. Every year he picking out whoever somebody says is the top, he going at him. When they meet, he going at him. And that's how I feel he's trying to do. He got a little tipple. So I said when he came back in, Kobe is going to do his thing. I said it when we talked about the preseason. Kobe is going to do his thing. And the performances he put on the last week or so have said it all. So I think this is part of him just motivating himself, keeping himself on edge. And when you just take if you talk about just straight killers in the league, you got to have Kobe there. I agree with him with Derrick Rose. CP3, I love CP3. I saw his performance, great performance against the Lakers last year. I'm still trying to evaluate him on the killer level. Durant is definitely in that killer zone. You got to put D-Wade in that killer zone that he talked about. D-Wade has slipped a little bit because in his last year because I think he was deferred a little bit too much. But Kobe is that cat that has no memory. He's like a relief. Mm-hmm. He's like a relief pitcher. He just has no memory. He might throw a home run, and then next night forget about he even did it. That's what I love about Kobe. So this is just motivation for him because he feels like he's being disrespected in his own time with the Clippers. He feels like he's just being disrespected all around. In the launch of this NBA season for him, it's been like, I thought y'all forgot. I'm just going to let you know I'm still here.
I agree, man. I think, you know, Kobe is that sleeper. You know, he's that old renegade right now. Right now, he's Omar Little. All right? He's Omar Little, and he's terrorizing the up-and-coming kingpins, you know. He robbing the stash house. You know, he taking out the lieutenants and the soldiers with no regard for who's supposed to be in charge right now. You know, he's definitely getting his Omar Little on. And again, I'm not a Kobe fan. I enjoy the man. I take nothing away from his game. That doesn't mean I can't appreciate what he does on the court. I'm just not a fan. But I'm appreciating what he's doing right now. I think it's interesting that he picked Chris Paul and Derrick Rose. And I think you could take it two ways. You can take it as he doesn't see them as quote-unquote threats to his legacy. Or he actually believes what he said. You know, I think it's easy to give credit to people who you don't really see as threatening your crown or coming for your crown. They're both point guards. They're not wing players. You know, I think for him to be able to Just knowing his track record and his public persona, I think it's really difficult for him to put another wing player in the same category as himself. I don't think that's really Kobe's style.
Yeah.
I think.
So I have a lot of criticisms about Kobe. You know, I've done it over the years. But one thing, if you put him on the killer list, if you talk about that dog meter, so you know I got the dog meter. On the
right.
dog meter, I don't know if everybody hired him on the dog meter. Who would you have in the league hired him on the dog meter?
Who would I have in the league? You know, I don't think there's anybody with the track record and the resume that he has as far as, because I think he's been at it longer than anybody else. Chris Paul will eat your face, though.
Yeah.
I've watched quite a few live CD games this year, and CP3 will go for your heart. Like, CP3 doesn't care. I think he's definitely in that category with Kobe. He doesn't have Kobe's track record, though. He doesn't have the history. Like I said, Kobe's Omar, and Omar had a rep that preceded him. All Omar had to do was whistle on the street in Baltimore, in West Baltimore, and the street cleared out. You know, all little hoppers, you know.
All the product fail,
all
the product fail,
all
the, out the
yeah.
window.
Yep. You know what I'm saying? And that's the Mamba. That's the cachet
right.
that the Mamba carries. CP3 is not at that level yet. He's not there yet where when people see him coming, they know they're in for it. You know, you either got to have a full arsenal behind you or you need to tuck tail. CP3 is not there yet, but watching
CP3 is like Marlo when he first came on the scene. You weren't quite sure what he was going to do, but you knew something was going to happen.
Right?
Right.
Right.
It's kind of like, you like, there's something about this cat that's going, his character is going to grow. that's CP3. His character, he's going to be menacing when he happens.
And for those out there that aren't aware of what we're talking about a show that's near and dear to the heart of the RSG crew, which is HBO's The Wire. If you haven't seen it, catch all 5 seasons on DVD. Get yourself a nice weekend. You know, sit down with your significant other and run through a season or two. It's a deeply engaging show about, you know, the drug trade and the political scene. And just the whole social fabric of West Baltimore and Baltimore in general. You should check it out. HBO's The Wire. Get it on DVD. All right, you'll thank me later. Right now, we got a special guest on joining us. I'm going to allow D. Wills to introduce him appropriately so that he gets his title correct. So go ahead and run that, D. Wills.
Well, this brother needs no introduction. In terms of higher education, he's the thought leader in America, chief diversity officer. He is the vice provost for diversity and climate at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. But he is what I call an RSD guy through and through. He's the kind of cat that can talk about anything you want to talk about and anything you want to do as it relates to higher education and other fields. But when it comes to sports, he's a straight B. He'll debate it with you. He'll demonstrate his knowledge of the sports game. He's like the cat you need to have in the barbershop. So welcome to the show, my man, my dog, Damon Williams. What's up, brother? Welcome to the Real Sports Guy.
Hey, man, what's up? Been a long time coming. Just checking in from D.C., driving back here to Madtown. So glad I could be on the show and rip with y'all tonight, man. Y'all bringing it already. That's what's up.
Hey, man, you're a Kobe fan.
What do you
think about
it? Couple things, man. First off, there was an issue of Slam magazine that dropped about 2 years ago, which by about 16 to 18 months predated the Jay-Z Kanye West collabo Watch the Throne, and the title of the magazine was Watch the Throne, and it showed Kobe knocking down that fadeaway jumper that he's so known for. And everything that's going on right now, man, is basically about Kobe saying, you know what, I'm still here. I'm not going nowhere. I'm still holding it. You still got to watch the throne. You still got to respect your elders. And the comments that came out of his mouth with respect to D. Rose and CP3, I thought it was pretty interesting for the points that you noted and others noted. I think it was Marcus but also for a couple of points that were not noted. One, you got to understand the psychology of Kobe Bryant. And so for him, being a beast is not just being a ruthless competitor on the floor, but being a beast also is what you do, what you put into the game outside of the time that you're on the floor. And the people that he identified, there's some key distinguishing characteristics about both of them and how their games have evolved in the time that they've been in the league. Kobe looks at a cat like a D-Wade. He looks at a cat like a LeBron James. He looks at a cat like a Dwight Howard. And he finds the same flaws in their game 5 years, 6 years, 8 years in that existed in their game early on. And when you hear his comments, he talks about people that can bring it competitively the way he does. And so I think there's some other players in the league who bring that same type of ruthless competition to the floor. I think Rajon Rondo's a ruthless competitor. I think Kevin Garnett's a ruthless competitor. But the thing in terms of like what you put into it outside the game, it's a whole bunch of people that fell off, man. And, you know, to be 6'8", to get on an LBJ tip, to be 6'8", not to have no post work, not to have no footwork, and to still have the same flaws in your game that you had coming in the league, that's a problem, man. And you can't carry the throne because ultimately what happens when crunch time happens is that defenses, they capitalize upon your weaknesses. In the same instance, too, with Kobe, the ruthlessness that makes him that dude is also the thing that can allow him to get a little bit out of control at times. And one of the things that I'm hopeful for with him and that Lakers squad in particular is that they'll be able to temper. He'll be able to temper the fire just a little bit to sustain himself through this short season such that come time that it gets real, he can do what he needs to do to close out games and he can do what he needs to do to close out series.
That's what I told y'all.
Well put.
I told y'all, this cat brings it. It brings it. So when you look at the early part of the NBA season, what's your analysis? What do you see right now in this early part? I know at night you got them all taped. What's your early thoughts?
Absolutely. You know, we got the new multimedia center at the new crib. I'll be broadcasting games crazy style at night. So I'm always taping games and checking it out and breaking down tape. Couple things, man. I think when you look at the Eastern Conference, you got some surprises. And probably the number one surprise that I see is what's going on with that Philly squad. You know, Doug Collins has always been known for being a guy that can take a mediocre team and make them competitive and take a competitive team and candidly make them good. What he has the evidence is the ability to take a good team and make them a championship-caliber team. But he's got a lot of young players who have bought into his system. Elton Brand is fit for the first time in many years, which coincides with the fact that this is a contract year getting ready to come up for Big Elton. And he's got some players who really, I think, are poised to take that next step, particularly Drew Holiday, who's one of my favorite young point guards in the league. So big up to what Doug Collins has been doing. I don't think that they'll hold on to this number one seed for the whole season, but I do think that they will finish in the top three seed, and they'll make noise in the East. I think the other thing that you have to really be surprised at is, in some ways, the struggles of what's happened with Boston. You know, Boston is in the midst of the worst losing streak in the history of the Big Three / Big Four, and candidly, it's the chickens coming home to roost of Danny Ainge making that horrific trade whereby he sent the anchor of their defense with Kevin Garnett out west. That was a horrible trade. It's unfortunate what happened with Jeff Green, but the bottom line of it is that he should not have made that move. He should have preserved the core, the integrity of their five, because the thing with that group is that they're better than the sum of their parts. The other thing is, again, the Heat are who we thought they are. They're the most athletic team in the league. They've got the two most dynamic perimeter players in the league, but they're a team with deep flaws. You know, Dwayne Wade is a cat who's always going to suffer with injury. LeBron James is a cat who's, you know, I like to say, built like Tarzan, but in terms of them last minutes of crunch time, when things get tight, play like James. You know, and the bottom line of it is that guy is mentally soft. He is mentally soft. He is a beast. He is a great player, but he's mentally soft. So, again, we are who we thought they were. So when I turn my attention to the West, I think that the major storylines were early on, of course, what happened with Commissioner Stern intruding into the league and exercising his power and influence into shaping what ultimately will shift the conversation and potentially the power structure of the Western Conference for the next 3 to 5, 6 years. You know, I got to comment a little bit on it. David Stern, what he did, it was all about the money. It wasn't about competitive balance. That was a good trade that was put forward by the Lakers. Yeah, I'm a fan, and yeah, I'm still stung by that. And yeah, I got to get that off my chest because I'm on the phone with the real sports guy. So that was done for business reasons. It was not done for anything competitively, and it was I thought abuse of power, and it was obfuscated by the fact that he wanted to come and, you know, use all these other rationales about why he did it. The other piece that's related to that, then, I think the big storyline is what happened with the Lakers ultimately and the move of moving Lamar Odom. And in some ways, you know, I find that to be this new bust regime that I'm not feeling. And candidly, it was a decision that was made for money reasons. They cut Lamar, or they moved Lamar, rather, for no tangible benefit to the team, really. And what it did ultimately is it allowed them to shave $8 million off the cap, which was the $8 million he paid plus the $8 million they had to pay in luxury tax for him, which, you know, I understand it, but I think in Kobe Bryant's golden era, I think he deserves better than that. And I think they need to put a team around him to be able to compete for the long term. In terms of that Laker team, like I said, they are they're big, they're long. Andrew Bynum has been the most improved player this year, not because I think he took such a huge step, but because he's put together 12 solid months of health and been able to just mature into the type of player that I think he can become. Paul Gasol is soft as jello, and candidly, I think he still remains on the trading block. But rather than making a move of Andrew Bynum for Dwight Howard, the move that I think that Laker team really needs is to move Paul Gasol for a dynamic point guard, a dynamic guy on the perimeter. Kobe's the only guy that can get his own shot. Then he's another guy that can create opportunities for others to preserve Kobe, but more importantly, to be able to execute that horrific offense that Mike Brown has put in place. If you have noticed, it is a one-man offense, just like it was in Cleveland. I love what he does defensively, but offensively it's horrible. One last point on the Western Conference is I really like what Lob City is going to be entertaining. But Lob City, candidly, is going to go so far as Chauncey Billups and CP3 and Caron Butler take them. They're going to need real vets who know how to make real plays when it really gets crunch time. And I love what they've got. The final thing is the Oklahoma City Thunder. Oklahoma City is scared because Kevin Durant is a true closer. Russell Westbrook is a dynamic, if out of control at times, scorer and perimeter player. I love Ibaka. I love Kendrick Perkins giving us some real men in the post. But I think there's a trade out there, actually, that makes them a better team. You heard it here first. I don't know if it'll happen. They haven't signed Westbrook, but you know where I would trade Westbrook? I'd move Westbrook straight up for Rajon Rondo. And the reason I would do that is I believe it would create it would allow for Kevin Durant to fully ascend to the type of dominance that he's capable of, and you would bring in a true floor general, yes, with flaws, but who's a ruthless competitor, and ultimately I think would make the total team a better team. Don't know if it would happen, but I would make the move straight up. It would work for Boston, too, because it would energize them with the type of young, athletic scorer they need that they can build around, and Rondo would be a perfect fit as a strategic piece that just takes a team to the next level.
Doc, you keep doing it.
I wish I had a Funk Master Flex Bomb. I wish I had a Flex Bomb to drop. I'm gonna have to get some Flex. I'm gonna have to get that Flex Bomb sound, man. That can only be followed by a Flex Bomb.
Oh man, Devon, to tell you fellas, I love NBA hoops, man. We have to have you over to the house, man. I got a 130-inch screen in my basement, and can run three games simultaneously, man. I'll be down there like Michael Wilbon, man, taking shit to the lab.
Hey, I want to get PhD in. He had some thoughts on Kobe. I like that trade suggestion. I had a trade suggestion for the Lakers as well. I'm going to run that by you after I let PhD jump in real quick. Go ahead, PhD.
Well, the Kobe thought, you know, I think Williams was right on. One thing I like to add there is Kobe has always been about winning. Think about his issues with Shaq, his run-ins with Phil Jackson. You know, his impatience with Andrew Bynum when he wanted Jason Kidd a few years ago. Kobe has always been about winning. And even though he could probably be much, much more marketable than what he is right now, he has chosen to focus on winning. And I think when you look at Derrick Rose and Chris Paul, you know, these guys are fairly nondescript, and it's all about winning for them as well. You look at D-Wade, you look at LeBron. I'm not saying winning is not important to them, but, you know, Bron's already said that his brand is extremely important to him as well. And it is for all these guys, but just the way that they're perceived, I think that feeds into why Kobe selected Paul and Rose opposed to some of the other guys that we may think would come out, you know, before them in terms of Kobe's picks, you know, for a comparison. Also relevant is what Roland Lazenby said, you know, who's wrote a couple of really good books, Blood and Horns, you know, following Jordan's Bulls, and he's also, you know, in the process of writing another biography on Jordan. He just posted that Jordan pretty much said that Kobe is really the only person that merits a comparison to me because of what he's accomplished and his work ethic. So I think when you put all those things in perspective, you know, I think Kobe has earned the right to say, wait a minute, don't compare these cats to me quite yet. And if you have to, here's the guys that I think are most relevant to the conversation.
Absolutely. We there?
Yeah, I'm here.
I couldn't agree more with you, man. You know, one of the things about the whole Kobe thing that a lot of people they don't understand is greatness is defined by what happens when no one's looking. And greatness is defined by the seriousness with which you approach your craft, whatever your chosen craft is. And, you know, when I get up in the morning and do what I do, I want to be amongst the best in the world at it. Period, end of story. It takes a tremendous amount of courage to want to be the best and amongst the very best in the world at what you do, and to have the courage, your convictions to say it, go out and put it on the line every day to accomplish it. Most people wilt under the pressure of that. Hate him or love him, Kobe Bryant never wilts under the pressure of that, and he is the most professional, serious basketball player in the league. Because the one thing we didn't acknowledge, is he is balled out with the wrist. I mean, who's missing games right now? Dwayne Wade, 4 years younger than him. LeBron James, 6-7 years younger than him. Missing games, talking about my ankle hurt. You know, talking about my foot hurt. Man, strap it up, tip it up, fall out. Don't come at me with that. You know, come back again, man. Come back again. Not you, but them, man. That's weak, man. That's weak.
I dig that. You know, you raised an interesting point with the hypothetical trade that you threw out there, Westbrook for Rondo. Now,
yeah.
I had texted the guys about a week and a half ago. I was just sitting around. I was watching Oklahoma City play, and then I think I had watched the Lakers earlier in the week. And I think it was a little bit, a couple days before Steve Blake got injured. And I texted the fellas, and I just threw it out there. And I want to throw it out there. You're a Laker fan. I want to throw it out there to you.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Lakers would have to probably pull in a couple more pieces, maybe a pick, third party. But Westbrook for Gasol, I think it works well for both teams. It allows, because I think the Thunder need an inside presence, an inside scoring presence, because Durant is still a jump shooter right now. He doesn't have a back-to-the-basket game. They can't dump the ball into him and have him get to the line or get buckets. Like, I think they're going to need eventually. And I think with Harden coming on, plus they got Eric Maynard in tow, they just drafted a point guard in Reggie Jackson. I think they can make do at the point position. Maynard is a great floor general. That's probably his best skill. So I think they could get by, and they would benefit from having a Gasol who can score with his back to the basket and get some tough buckets around the rim. And then I think the Lakers get more athletic on the perimeter, which
right.
I think they get a dynamic playmaker in Westbrook, who, again, when once Kobe does decide to start to slip, which I think he still has another 2 or 3 years, once he does decide to slip, that's another guy who can go out and get 30 or 25 to 30 on a given night.
Right. You know, it's interesting, man. You know, a couple things. One thing is that, you know, I'm about to get off some real stuff here. You know, the Lakers have a particular image and a brand as an organization which is really very distinctive versus the other brands of other NBA franchises. And the person who's going to be the franchise player, the face of the Lakers, has to have the potential to be a star among stars. And in saying that, there's got to be some qualities about that individual that transcend the basketball floor. And candidly, Russell Westbrook doesn't have the mouthpiece nor the presence to be the face of the Los Angeles Lakers. He has talent in many ways, but I think for that reason, I think L.A. would never make that trade. I think that, you know, it'd be more likely that they bring in a Derek Williams. They tried to do CP3. You know, but then to comment a little bit about Westbrook's game, I think that your analysis of the trade is spot on, brother. I think Gasol would do wonders for their ability to, you know, be able to make plays and have a true playmaker and scoring threat on the interior, which would be awesome for Oklahoma City. I don't think L.A. would put Westbrook in the same backcourt with Kobe. In many ways, I think that would be as flawed as Westbrook next to Kevin Durant, or as flawed as bringing Mario Ellis, or not Mario Ellis, what's the boy's name up at Golden State?
Monte.
Yeah, it'd be like putting Monte and Kobe together. They're both scorers at the perimeter, and I don't think that would really be a good fit with Kobe. I think in Kobe's golden years and having a true dominant threat in the center with Andrew, or potential dominant in Andrew, I think you really need a true point guard. Mike Brown's system is predicated on the point guard bringing it up the floor and creating plays for others. Russell Westbrook is a two guard, and that's the reason why I would love to see him move somewhere where he could truly be that dominant scorer. Because right now there's a battle going on for the soul of that Oklahoma City team. And I put my money on a 6'11", 7-foot dude that can put it on the floor.
It's interesting because this whole discussion about how do you let two stars or three stars coexist on the same team. We had that happen all the time in the 80s. And one of the things I began to look at, because one of the great things about having that NBA pass, I could watch a lot of basketball for free for a couple weeks. And I caught up on a lot of things. And one of the things that I saw, coaches don't set the rotations correctly. So one of the things I think that I see in Oklahoma City is that there are some times where they're bumping each other trying to figure out who's going to shine down the stretch. But I also don't see the type of rotation where you might let a Russell Westbrook run a little bit longer with that second unit. There are times I'm watching, I'm like, well, you should just keep Russell in for another 5 or 10 minutes. It would balance, it would allow them to stretch in a way that you see, that you had a chance to see teams in the 80s do. There were times when Byrne went to the bench, but it was McHale time.
And you knew.
What?
One thing about that, D, that I think is, I would have a slightly counter perspective on that is as follows. The one thing about all those great teams from the 80s is the pieces fit together. And, you know, there's too many players in the NBA currently that replicate the same skill set. They can penetrate, take it to the hole, and they want to chuck threes. The NBA game, in terms of the mid-range jump shot and the true back-to-the-player game, has been – those are lost and dying arts. If you go back to that great Celtics team that you cited, it was great for a number of reasons. Number one, Kevin McHale was a dominant back-to-the-basket four-man. Number two, you had DJ, who lived in the mid-range jump shot. Then you had Bird, who was dominant across the floor, Ainge, who was a spot-up shooter, and Robert Parrish, who filled the lane and was a classic big man, and could step out and knock down a jumper. So there was a great diversity of offensive skill set on that team. And if you look at all the great teams of that era, the Philly teams, the Laker teams, the Trailblazer teams, they all had dudes that could do multiple things. You look at a lot of these great teams that you see now, you don't see a team. You see a team like the Heat. You know, LeBron James can't hit no mid-range jumper to save his life, nor can Dwayne Wade. They're the exact same player, and they want to occupy the same space on the floor. The thing that makes that big four great historically up in Boston. The current Big Four is they occupy different spaces on the floor and they bring different offensive tools to the game. Paul Pierce can kill you with the mid-range, can kill you with the long range. Ray Allen moves without the ball, catches and shoots it. You go back to that great Detroit team that I know you love that won the most recent championship for them. That team had players that could be dominant without the ball, and when you put it all together, more than the sum of their parts. Going back to their Oklahoma City team, Kevin Durant, even though he's 6'11", and Russell Westbrook is 6'4", they got the same offensive games, unfortunately.
But what I would say is that issue is not Westbrook's issue. That's Durant's issue. Because what you just said is Durant, you can't have a 6'3", 6'4", guard guarding you.
Right.
So part of the problem is Durant hasn't expanded his game. Because I think if Durant was able to play even in the mid-range post and do everything, you would begin to see that combination work. So because he has not expanded to that place yet, and that's where you have to be patient. If Durant had that little mid-range post game down there, then you wouldn't see him occupying the same space. So I think part of it is back then we even allowed people to mature, to be able to get to places in a way that we don't allow to mature now. You can even look at the Milwaukee Bucks back then when they had all those cats, Ricky Pierce, you had Cummings, you had all these cats. Well, it looked like they were all the same cats, Sidney Moncrief. But what they did was between how you managed the rotation, because you can create some of that through how you manage the rotation. Who you have on the floor? If you got Maynard on the floor and you got Westbrook on the floor and you got some other cats on the floor, you create a different type of set in space. So part of it, I still go back to the fact that I agree with you with some of the things that the players, the mid-range game is lost. I agree with that. But I also believe that coaches coach sometimes like they coach the AAU team. Mm. And they let cats play in a way that they did let cats play before. They don't manage it in a way that they could manage. And I just, as watching for 2 weeks, I overdosed on NBA pass. I overdosed on them. And that kept coming back to me time and time again, that we have to be patient. We have to be thinking about our rotations. How you set the lineup creates what you want. And how do you work with people like Durant to develop other aspects of the game so that you can create the kind of continuity you need in the offense?
Well, I think you hit an incredible point, and that's player development and guys haven't been allowed to mature and develop. Andrew Bynum is a beast and has great fundamentals. Why? Because he was tutored by the great Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
That's right.
So he knows how to play the big man game, and he was taught that. And I think one of the things that NBA coaches have to do is to carry that extra guy on the coaching roster who can help Kevin Durant develop a pinch-post game, can help him to develop a back-to-the-basket game, because and can help LeBron James understand how to play without the ball. The big problem with LeBron James is he doesn't know how to move. The great thing about Kobe Bryant that's allowed his game to evolve, Kobe Bryant can run off picks like Rip Hamilton, or he can handle it off the dribble. And that's a subtlety that's about understanding how to play the game. And these guys don't know how to play the game. They're great athletes. They have great skill sets. But to truly understand how to master your craft, you have to understand all the zones and how to play the game and how to help your team. And there's not a lot of that. And I think it only happens if they have a dedicated type of tutorial like Andrew Bynum did.
Now, I want to say this. We would be remiss to have you get off the phone because I did. And the fellas, I'm about to throw a curveball on, but we got a cat who can speak to this. So I want to have him before he gets off the phone. Last week we had Alan Sack, who is the author of Counterfeit Amateurs. He's one of the leading experts in terms of looking at what's happening with college sports in terms of professionalism and amateurism, that whole debate. And I know that you've been intimately involved and have a lot of thoughts on what's happening with the college game in terms of the state of the college game. But one of the things I've been really pushing on is what do we need to do to start to cultivate particularly black athletes in the way that we have historically, in terms of the Lou Alcindors of the world, in terms of the political consciousness that we had in the '60s. I know we got a different game, But the way in which cats were able to really engage in the academic side as well as the athletic side of the game. And I know you have some thoughts about this, but I definitely want to pick your brain since we got you in, because I think it's important for folks to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, I'm here. I appreciate that, D. And I think that, you know, what we see in the sports game is it's just one context where it manifests kind of what we see overall in the African-American community and overall what we see in our youth, in our African-American youth. And, you know, there's been, you know, one of the great challenges has been the emergence of the commercialization of AAU basketball, the emergence of the immediacy with which the internet and social media allows for us to heap on and aggrandize young boys and telling them that there's something that they're not. It's the absence of role models and the absence of father figures in the home that provide for folks the images of leadership and the images of possibility, you know, and it's the absence of a seriousness in terms of how athletes approach the academic world, the way they approach the athletic world. We look back to the Lou Alcindors, the Jim Browns, you know, the Carlos Snows. When we look back at those athletes who were really, really iconic and really made a difference in terms of political engagement, those guys were great scholars. They were great athletes, and there was a seriousness with which they approached the work in the classroom and outside the classroom. That seriousness is not there for too many of our young men in particular. You know as well as I the issues that we face with respect to graduation rate of African-American athletes in Division I institutions, which is just, you know, even worse than what we see in graduation rates in African-American students overall. You know, it's funny. I get asked a lot of times kind of, you know, what's the solution to these mega challenges, these meta challenges that exist at a societal level? And, you know, my response to that is, number one, there's never one magic bullet solution that could be put in place to say that if we do this, we'll be able to make a difference. But I think a key part of it is we have to elevate the conversation, and we have to elevate the need for us to become more serious about how we not take advantage of our athletes when they come into our institutions, how we not allow for them to come in and spend 3, 4, 5 years on campus and leave with no degrees, leave without the educational platform that allowed them to do lots of things in their life. Because as you know, as the whole team that's online knows, the majority of these guys aren't going pro, and they're young and they're immature and they waste the opportunity. And so I think we have to continue to elevate the conversation. I think the NCAA has made some strides in that regard. President of the NCAA is Mark Emmert. I know President Emmert from, you know, some work he and I did together over the last couple years. President Emmert actually is a guy who has some principles of diversity and equity that are personally important to him. He's made some real important contributions to this work in higher education overall. He was former chancellor at University of Connecticut, where I was, former chancellor at LSU, former president at University of Washington, and each of those institutions made some real great contributions and has gone off to the NCAAs and tried to get some more work done. But it's beyond President Emmert's power and capacity. But, you know, I think we have to keep elevating the conversation and doing things like we're doing right now at the University of Wisconsin-Madison with a new project. And with the athletic department, my office, and Professor Jalando Jackson, the School of Ed, which is called Beyond the Game. And Beyond the Game is all about how do we prepare our athletes for life beyond the game. And it's something that's been deeply embraced by Coach Alvarez, under the leadership of Deputy Director Sean Frazier, my office, a key partner in that. And, again, it's elevating it, but it's not just elevating it. It's saying what can we do proactively to make a difference around these issues, and not being afraid of the criticism that may come, you know, and holding coaches accountable for more than just athletic prowess and excellence. How do we hold coaches accountable for academic prowess and excellence? You know, it was shameful what happened to Coach Paterno Hate to see him go out that way. It had to go down the way it had to go down. But there was a lot of good lessons that Coach Paterno was associated with for years about doing things for the most part in the right way. And I think that those values of doing things in the right way have been lost, and we need to find a way to reclaim them.
This is what I'm talking about. I know, Phil, PhD, I know you got a quick question here before Doc leaves, so I want you to get up here. What am I?
Doc, it's been great listening to your points. Very impressed with what you've said. As Devon mentioned, we had Dr. Alan Sack on last week, and you know, he's the author of top-selling book, Counterfeit Amateurs. And, you know, just the name in itself, Dr. Sack argued that because of the demands placed on athletes at large Division I institutions, that it's almost like a work relationship. This concept of amateurism is almost a thing of the past. What are your thoughts on that statement?
Yeah, I'd have to agree with Dr. Sack. I think that, you know, particularly when you are when you're playing Division I sports in particular, there is a professionalization of your approach to the work, to the athletic endeavor. I mean, these young men and women spend more time on average probably preparing, training, watching film, practicing, performing than they do engaging their academic studies. And, you know, Jalen Rose yesterday was he was on some show and he was talking about this. And, you know, Jalen's a Michigan man, and even though, you know, Michigan's tried to divorce him from the family, he is a really, I think, a powerful representation of, you know, an urban inner-city kid who took full advantage of the educational platform that was given to him. He did not graduate, but he became educated in his time at Michigan and has continued to educate himself. He's a very impressive guy. A lot of people underestimate him, but one of the things Jalen said was very compelling, and it relates to this point. Jalen says, you know, yes, we get a scholarship. He said, but there's lots of merit scholarships that are given at an institution. You can get a scholarship for playing the violin. You can get a scholarship at Madison if you're a great poet. You can get a scholarship if you can run a 4.140. The major difference is the kid that runs that 4.140 makes millions of dollars for his institution. And, you know, college football in particular is, hear me when I say this, the biggest money maker in all of sport. You know, there are 28 NFL teams that fill up stadiums that have roughly 50 or 60,000 seats. Yes, they have merchandising. Every state in the continental United States, plus the contiguous territories that align with the United States, has a major Division I football team that fills up their stadium oftentimes with excess of 55 and 60,000. And there's not just one team that does that. In many states, there may be two, three, and four teams that do that. You take that revenue generated through tickets, through bowl appearance, through TV revenue, through merchandising, you have a sports complex that is of a level that it has to be considered professionalized. I think that we should compensate players. I don't know what form or fashion we should do so. Amateurism, as we have known it in the past, is gone. I think we should use revenue-generating sports to help underwrite how we might help to compensate non-revenue-generating sports, which will help us to satisfy requirements of Title IX and treating women and men equally in what we do. But I think we should continue to open up those conversations and explore them because the scholarship is important. But I think that these young people should be provided at least some type of a minimum wage that allows them to be able to support themselves, not walk around with lint in their pocket, and hopefully, ultimately, allow them to make better decisions so they don't have to feel like they have to sell memorabilia to go buy Burger King. Or as Chris Webber classically said, you know, my jersey is hanging all around here and I don't have money for McDonald's. That's a problem.
Right. That's what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about. This is one of the premier scholars in the country and in the world. He's going to be coming out with his book this year. I hope you can come back and
Absolutely.
Spend some time with us, my man. This
Absolutely.
One, doing work, but if you get them, by the bar talking some football, ESPN ain't got nothing on us.
ESPN, the real sports guys. Hey, fellas, it's been real. Hey, Big God, we're so glad to be on the show finally. Thank you, gentlemen, for allowing me the time to express my thoughts. God bless you. Have a nice evening.
All right, brother.
I gotta give him a Singletary on that one. I gotta give him
I want
Singletary.
Winners.
He brought it. Fantastic.
I'm trying to tell you.
If you don't know what you're listening to right now, you're listening to the Real Sports Guys, Real Guys Talk Real Sports. If you want to get on with us, feel free to call in at 1-347-989-0844. As they say in the streets, man, it's provocative. It gets the people going. All right, we're going to transition to talking this top 50, man. We've been doing this little experiment, this little social experiment we got going on where each of us is taking the NBA top 50 that they did a couple years ago back in the mid-90s. The NBA had its 50-year celebration. They did the top 50 players in the league history, and we're going to rewrite that, update it for 2011 or 2012. And right now, we're at the apex of our mountain, of each of our individual mountaintops, and we're slowly climbing to the top. Right now, this week, we're going to go through our 10 through 6 ranked players in our top 50. I'm going to kick it off and introduce my 10 through 6, and then we're going to bounce back and forth and see if there's any discrepancies, any players in my top 10 that anybody has a problem with. At number 10, I have Hakeem the Dream Olajuwon. At number 9, I have the logo, Jerry West. At number 8, the most distinguished, Bill Russell. At number 7, I have Mr. Do-It-All, a.k.a. the Big O, a.k.a. Oscar Robertson.
That's right.
And at number 6, I have Dr. J. So that's it right there. I think that's airtight. I'm waiting on the crickets.
Well, I think the one I'm surprised about is Dr. J. Talk a little bit about Dr. J.
Errors, man. I didn't really get to see Doc. I have Doc that high because, you know, I know my history. I know Doc's relevance and importance to the game. I know the significance of Doc, but I don't have, other than Doc taking the ball, sticking it out of bounds, wiping somebody's nose with it who was in the front row, and then bringing it back around and landing up on underneath the glass, I don't really have a whole lot of Doc moments in my memory banks. So that's why I had to put Doc at 6. Most of the guys I have in my top 5 are guys who I've seen play or I've seen a ton of footage of. I haven't seen a ton of Doc. So that's why I got Doc there. Again, it's not a slight to Doc. When you see my top 5, I don't know who you would take out and put Doc in for.
Right.
Well, what I was looking at is because, I mean, I was just trying to figure out, and Doc is one of my favorite players growing up, so I watched a lot of Doc every Sunday. There were about 3 or 4 teams that played every Sunday. Milwaukee played, Philadelphia played, Boston played, you get L.A. play, and every once in a while you might get the Mavericks or something like that. But I love Doc. I'm a Doc fan. I was a Philly fan. What I was thinking about, where Doc could do it all. Doc's mid-range to long-range game wasn't that strong, and sometimes he could get away with it because he could get to the basket. Wasn't that strong always going to the left, always. But I think he was a pretty strong defender. So I see him as a lead player. I mean, he's a top 15 player. But I, when you put him at, if you would have said Doc at 9 or 10, I'd be like, okay, I can understand that. Doc at 6, I know your top 5 is strong. I know that. But what I can say is I got a lot of respect for the fact that you got Doc at 6. So I'm not even critical of it.
Okay.
I have a lot of respect that as a young cat, we all are like we kind of got a lineage. We bump up against each other in limited generation. But the fact that you would have at 6 says a lot about how you approach this.
Yeah.
So that's what I say. It's not really a criticism. What it is, and it, I have Doc at 6, but I respect the fact that you have him at 6. So I'll say
okay.
That. I don't have a debate.
Yeah, again, man, I didn't get to see Doc. And what I understand of Doc was that he was Mike before Mike. He was that transcendent player who took the ABA and then elevated it to an equal level status as a league with the NBA until the merger. And then even into the NBA, he was still that transcendent personality. And, you know, I remember the Doc I remember was the Doc with the beard and mustache from, you know, NBA on NBC. You know, back in the mid-90s.
That's right.
You know, when
that's
he was
right.
Part of the studio crew. And all of the respect and love that he gets throughout the basketball community, that's me paying homage to Doc. That's why I got him at 6. So
I can respect it. I can respect the hustle. I have to say that.
And for the listeners out there that wasn't with us a few years ago, where we left off, Devon had Dr. J at 15 on his list, and I had Dr. J at 20, and the game changer has him at 6. One of the guys I'd like to ask you about, Marcus, is Jerry West. You got Jerry West at 9. Devon also, I had him at 16. And you got him at 9. Talk to me a little bit about Jerry's game.
Now, again, I haven't seen him live, but everything I've read about Jerry West was he was a pretty unstoppable force in the backcourt. A killer lefty, excellent mid-range shooter, excellent ball handler, depth passer. And Jerry was a winner. Jerry played on good teams. Jerry, again, was another player who was somewhat of a transcendent player. You know, Damon brought up the fact that the Lakers, the guy who's the guy with the Lakers has to be a person who is transcendent and a person who is more than just a skill set. And, of course, the logo is that. I mean, he's a living representation of the league. He's a visual
right.
representation of what the league is about. So that's why I had Jerry in my top 10. Phenomenal scorer, phenomenal ball player, good defender. There wasn't a whole lot that Jerry West couldn't do during his era as a basketball player.
I want winners.
I told you, there was one guy who was in my top 20 who didn't have any rings. And we all know who that is. So that's why I had Jerry there. And, you know, I know when we first unveiled these, there was some conversation as to why I had Kobe so low in comparison to you two. Because you guys, you know, we stopped at 11. You guys still haven't revealed where Kobe is in your list yet. And I had Kobe at 13. And I said that he wasn't even the highest rated perimeter player in his own franchise. And again, Kobe still has a way to go for me as far as surpassing Jerry West, you know, surpassing Kareem, surpassing Magic as the preeminent perimeter player in Laker lore. And I think he'll eventually get there. I don't doubt that he'll, especially watching him this season, he seems to be very much rejuvenated. He seems to definitely have a few more clips in the holster of his proverbial artillery. So, you know, I think Kobe, you know, in another year or two, if we do this in another 5 years, I think Kobe will have moved up my list. But that's where I got him right now. I still think he does have some work to do.
This will be an interesting year because I think this is a year that he could, with the way I view that team is going to go as far as he can take them. And if he's got to score 30 points a game and that team is a 1 or 2 seed, if he's not scoring at the clip that he's scoring at, I don't see that team being a top 5 team in the West. So if that team is a top 5 team in the West, if they're a 1 or 2 seed in the West, I think it's going to be mostly because Kobe Bryant has had a resurrection, so to speak. Not that he went anywhere, you know. Like I said, don't call it a comeback. I've been here for years. You know, not saying it's a comeback season. It's not a comeback season, but, you know, it's definitely a reestablishing of a reasserting of his dominance, so to speak, with Kobe being Bryant. So
strong list.
That's my
– strong.
That's – yeah. I mean, the top – like I said, my top 10 I feel is airtight. We can debate about who's where a little bit, but for the most part, I feel my top 10 is airtight. Yeah. So.
Okay.
Now, we're going to roll into a segment we like to call 5 on the Black Hand Side. In this segment, we take 5 topics and we really dig into them. You know, each of us gets a turn at giving our opinion on something that's happened, something that's going down out there in the community, out there in the sports world. So we're going to go ahead and get into that.
Five, on the Black Hand Side.
Yes, sir. So this 5 on the Black Hand Side is going to focus on a lot of NFL. We're going to talk a lot of NFL right now as the season is winding down, the playoffs are ramping up. We're headed into the conference championship games. We just had the divisional round this past weekend. And it was a lot. It was a lot to talk about. A lot of crazy things happened. Some unexpected things happened. The first thing I want to get into is I'm gonna throw this one to PhD. What the hell happened to the Packers? Explain.
Well, I'm gonna take a page out of our guest host last week, Eric Hamilton, and our fantasy football guru, who like Devon and myself did pick the Giants to beat the Packers. And I think all three of us touched on the point, which came to fruition, was that the Packers are a timing offense, okay? An offense that we saw execute classic, timeless timing earlier in the season where they were clicking on all cylinders. The Giants did an excellent job of keeping them off balance. Similar to what Alabama did last week against LSU. They gave them so many different looks. So in my mind, the Packers look rusty. And with a timing offense that's built on precision, and we saw this a little bit with the Saints earlier in the season, if one or two gears are off, it makes the whole system look a bit off. And so the offense, which is used to scoring 35 to 40 points, just couldn't do that. And we certainly saw the weaknesses of the Packer defense.
Okay. D-Wills, what say you?
Well, we all called it last week. And part of it was funny because, you know, I worked in Wisconsin, around a lot of Green Bay fans. And when I said the Giants were the matchup that the Packers did not want to see, everybody was like, no. Because what they could do is they could rush 4. They could get away with rushing 4. They could adjust on the back end of the defense, work on taking away Finley, really make him throw, harass Rodgers, and just do all that. And then Eli stepped up. I mean, I got to say this because Game Changer and I have been going back and forth. Eli stepped up this year. I was talking to, you know, Damon off the air before we got on the show. He was driving back, and he was, you know, he broke it down with me. But I had to admit to him, I said, you know, I've been arguing with my guy on the air about Eli, and Eli stepped up. And I mean, just folks, it's about Coughlin. There are certain kind of coaches that are good for the playoffs. I've been watching this. Some coaches are not. They wear on you in the regular season, but their style is good for the playoffs. And Coughlin is that. He's a playoff style coach. When you need to bunker down, he's the general. That's his. That's where he lives. He's good at that. He's going to annoy you second week of October. You're going to be tired of hearing him there. But in January, he's the kind of voice you need to hear. And he's what I call a great – he's that playoff-type coach. Great game. This has been a hell of a playoffs, man. But the Pack, they got what they got. And it also speaks to why you shouldn't have people sit. And that's we argued about that, about sitting the playoffs. And I'm like, it's about – football players are creatures of habit. And they basically had, you know, close to 20 days off, 14 days, in considering the fact that they didn't play in the game, which probably they didn't practice much before the last game, they had too many days off.
I got to agree with you. I had a debate with one of my brothers. You know, I come from a sports family of athletes, and we talk sports every chance we get when we get together. And we were discussing, this was before the Chiefs lost, before the Packers lost to the Chiefs, we were discussing whether or not the Packers should go for 16-0. And, you know, as somebody who coaches, my philosophy as a coach is you never take your foot off the gas. When you got a rhythm going, you keep it going until somebody beats you. When you got a streak going, you play that out until somebody beats you. There's no point in playing for a game that you may or may not get to, which is the Super Bowl. You know, one of my brothers said that, well, you know, you have to set, if you have an opportunity, the goal is to win the Super Bowl. And I said, no, actually the goal is to win every game. And if you win every game, then damn it, you won a Super Bowl. And you have to go into every game with the mentality that we're going to win every game. And I dislike it when teams give up games by sitting guys. Now, the Packers didn't lose the game in which they sat Rodgers. But to me, to even take your foot off the throttle, especially in a sport, and the players that I coach, I tell them all the time that, you know, football, I always compare football to classical music. It's very structured. It's very timing-based. It's very there's a regimentedness to it that also attributes to its beauty. Basketball is like jazz. You can get five basketball players together just like you can get five jazz musicians together, and if everybody's competent in what they're doing, you can see some great basketball because it's a free flowing game. Where football is more scripted, it's more structured. There's still a ton of beauty to it, but it's more structured. And if that structure is broken, or if that rhythm is broken, or if timing is lost, it doesn't sound the same. It doesn't have that same luster. It doesn't have that same beauty. It doesn't move you the same way. And when you take Aaron Rodgers out the lineup for a week, for whatever reasons, that is going to have an effect, again, on a team that does run a timing-based system. And that system was humming. All right? It was humming. Especially given the fact that you have wrapped up the number one seed. So you are going to be sitting for a week additionally. So then you give them 2 weeks of rest. Again, as a coach, I would rather have players who are in rhythm and injured and a little banged up than players who are completely fresh and out of rhythm. That's my philosophy as a coach. Give me a group of players who are in rhythm and who are in sync with one another. And ready to play. They may be a little bit banged up, but damn it, they're professionals.
That's right.
And I think the Packers did themselves a disservice by playing it safe. And I'm going to do the research this week, and I want to go back and look at teams that have done that. Because to me, it doesn't seem like it always works out. It doesn't seem like it ever really works out the way that you want it to for that number one seed, that team that wraps it up early and then kind of coasts into the playoffs. To me, that never seems to work, but a lot of coaches swear by it. They swear by it. They rest your guys, this, that, and the other. I don't know if it works more. I don't know if it's as a beneficial practice, as an advantageous practice, as it's played out to be. As you can see, the last 2 years, the team that has had to fight to the last day to get into the playoffs seems to be the hottest. Last year was the Packers. The Packers made the playoffs by the skin of their teeth. They had to win their last four games to get into the playoffs, and on the last Sunday of the season, they were playing a win-or-go-home game. Same with the New York Giants. Last Sunday of the season this year, what are they playing? A win-or-go-home game. And the one seed in the playoffs, neither one of them made it to the championship round.
So like you described in my fantasy team, we made it in the last day and won. That's what
I'm
talking about
my fantasy team. I went 16-0. I went undefeated, baby, because I went after every game. I wasn't going to sit Cam Newton in week 14 because I had it wrapped up.
Game changer left the gas on the pedal.
I kept my foot on the pedal. I kept my foot to the floor. I'm plowing through all obstacles. I'm going all the way to the finish line. You dig?
Guys, I want to ask y'all a question. When you look at Eli Manning, because a lot of times the question was about the Packers, but I don't want to and I don't want to jump too far ahead on this. But when
we'll
you
go
look
ahead
at,
and jump to, just go ahead and jump to it. We can talk to Eli. He's number three.
I know. That's what I was going to say. I didn't want to jump over there. The question I was going to ask, because we can still go with the question that we're going to have on number three, but because on this one, with his performance, how do you compare Eli to Peyton in terms of playoff quarterbacks?
I would give Eli the nod. You guys know I'm not an Eli fan. But I think I have more appreciation for Eli than the general public and media has had. I think now people are starting to come around to Eli. And again, don't misconstrue what I'm saying. I'm not an Eli fan. I repeat, I am not an Eli fan. But I put Eli ahead of, I think, some other players who may have had better numbers and statistics. Phillip Rivers. Over the course of their career, I would rather have Eli Manning than Phillip Rivers or some other players who are out there. You know what I'm saying?
I'm still not putting him over Phillip, but I will keep going.
And in Fire North, Phillip is going to be shitty again next year.
No, I'm going to tell you. Well, we'll argue that one later.
Oh, man, I've been missing y'all, man. I've been missing y'all. I think Eli, I would put Eli ahead of Peyton. Eli has had a tougher road, and I think as good or not, if not a better record than Peyton in the playoffs. They both got a Super Bowl, and Eli has won more road games than a lot of quarterbacks who have won Super Bowls. I mean, what Eli has done with his team, winning on the road, being able to lead his team on the road, and yes, sometimes he has just not lost a game for his team, but I think that in itself is key. I mean, when you look at how hard it is to win in the playoffs, you know, playing well enough to just not lose it for your team is tremendous because you held up your end of the bargain as the quarterback. Because, again, it's cold. The weather ain't always great. And you just got to go out there and make sure you ain't the reason that your team loses. You may not necessarily have to be the reason that they win, but you definitely can't be the reason that your squad loses. And that's playoff football.
Wow, winning.
Didn't want to throw it off, but that, I was thinking about that, so I just kind of put it out there. So, Phil, I don't know if you have an opinion on that.
You guys nailed it. I certainly have an opinion on Tebow, so I'm holding my bullets for that one.
All right, well, here we go. Number two, is Tebow mania finally dead? PhD, unload, unleash and unload. Well, what is it that Skip Bayless say? Unleash Tim Tebow.
So your question is Tebow mania finally dead? And my answer is yes. The reason I say yes is because in our culture, we, you know, we see Kobe Bryant do his thing, we see Jordan see his thing, do his thing, and all of a sudden we're like, okay, what's next? We want more. We've already seen this movie. And so Tebow has already accomplished the unbelievable in terms of football. Even if he goes on the same kind of run he did last year, we'll be amazed, we'll be impressed, but it won't be at a mania level. I do think that he is only one big moment away from having a sports transcending event, which will draw in this non-football demographic. I mean, we have people that aren't even football fans watching Tebow because he's such an interesting guy. You love him, hate him, just very polarizing. So I think that aspect is still going to be there and will always be one knock away. But in terms of the mania that we've seen this season, I don't think we'll ever see that again in terms of Tebow mania because we've already seen the movie. And as impressive as it is, you know, we won't be as impressed to see the sequel.
D. Will, what do you think on Tebow mania, man?
Yeah, I mean, I think
dead.
Well, you know, Brady and Belichick try to they try to stump it out. Whatever they try to do, and I knew Belichick was going to do it because he just got that evil side to him. He wanted to just stump it out. And they did their best to stump it out. I think this was a great ride. I think calmer heads are coming down. I mean, Elway announced that he's going to come in as the starter. When I look at Tebow, I look at him as a second-year player who didn't have an offseason, who is the kind of player that needs an offseason. And that's how I'm judging him. I'm not getting into all the stuff, but I think the hype around him is, you know, we're a microwave generation. So, you know, the hype isn't going to be high. Now, if he gets off on a 6-0 start next year, I think he can come back. But he's going to have to do it broadening his skills, throwing a little bit more from the pocket, doing some things that he wasn't doing this year. You know, Elway said he's going to work with him. But I think if he has a good start next year, you could see some momentum coming because he's that kind of polarizing guy. He's going to create that kind of stuff just because, you know, in August the debate's going to start. It's just something about this kid. And it's not like he brings it. It's not like he offers it. Not like he says it. He's just being him, but there's something about him that's going to do it. It's going to subside for a while, but I got a feeling you're going to feel some rumblings. Right around July 1st, you're going to start feeling some rumblings. There's going to be some stuff coming out. Mark the tape. Elway's been working with him. He looks better. They're going to start, the chatter going to start again. He might have a couple nice preseason games, and that energy going to start up, and they're going to get hopeful again. I mean, that's just how it goes. And so I don't know if it's totally dead, but I don't think it's going to be at the height it was this year.
I'm saying this. We can close the casket. You know, we can grab Big Mama off the casket. She ain't got to scream no more. You know, we can turn out the lights in the church. We can have the grave digger come get the casket, get the body, put it in the back of the hearse, and we can get the procession going. All right? It's a wrap. Tebow mania is dead. Again, Tebow and that Denver team fed off of mediocre quarterback play by the opposing teams. They got lucky every week. It seems like every week the opposing team's best offensive option was out, which contributed to low-scoring games, which they could then be in, and Tebow could do his thing because he didn't have to produce a bunch of points. Next year, guess what? They get a first-place schedule. And it's going to be a bear and a beast. And they are not going to have the cupcakes that they had this year.
But
it's going to be a wrap. It's going to be just like the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. It's going to be like the Vikings last year after Favre left. Because with Favre, they had that excellent season. Then the next year, with Favre still in tow, they had a first-place schedule. And things didn't go like they thought they was going to go.
Game changer.
Okay? That's why the NFL is set up that way, for parity. It is hard. If you're not a legit contender, it is difficult to win back-to-back years. Ask Tampa Bay.
Game
ask
changer.
Minnesota. Ask
game
the New York
changer.
Jets. Ask
this, is what I was, this is what I want
call
to say
them.
To you. This is what I want to say to you. You sound too logical. You sound too rational. What about Tebow Mania was logical or rational? It was, that's the
like
thing
I
that made it to Mania. There was nothing about it was about Mason. People who got football eyes were seeing just what you saw. They played a couple of top quarterbacks, the ones they played, for the most part, other than Big Ben being hurt, got him. Brady got him twice, right? They're going to play, what, I think about 8-9 elite quarterbacks next year. That sounds too rational because the people who support Tebow, the hardcore people, aren't being rational.
Right, and this is what I'm saying is, to me, Tebow Mania doesn't happen if he doesn't win. If he doesn't win, there is no Tebow Mania. And he won't be winning next year. So people may still
that.
Be rooting for him. He still
that.
May have
we
a rabid fan base. He still may have a rabid fan base. Yeah, but this year, again, look at all what happened. Look at what all went in his favor this year. Look at
some
all
people
what
say
went
that.
In his favor this year.
Some people would say that's what comes with Tebow.
No, Tebow is not magical. He's not sprinkling bad. He's not sprinkling bad luck juice on the other team. it's like the year the Saints won the Super Bowl, and they had every bounce go their way. It's hard to replicate that. It's just like a team that gets by on defensive turnovers. That's gonna work for a year. The next year, you don't know if you're gonna get that. It's like the Packers. Last year, they had a nice run through the playoffs. Things bounced their way. The next year, you can't say it's going to happen in the same way. You're not going to get – when you got by off things just kind of turning your way, there's no guarantee that it's going to happen that way again. And next year, you're going to be playing a tougher schedule.
But he's having a full off season, so you don't think he's going to get better?
He may get better.
He had some nice throws. He has some
But again, what always happens with these flash-in-the-pan quarterbacks, Derek Anderson, Kevin Call, all right, what always happens with these dudes? Get a season on the game tape. Defensive coordinator getting the lab. Now they got a season of game tape on you. That sophomore year, Josh Freeman, that sophomore year, and it's hot.
All right. I'm just saying. You're going to have all called up on the show. They're going to be looking at it like game changer. I told you. You had no faith in us. You're going to have Reverend Ike calling you. You're going to have everybody their mother calling you.
Call me up. I am not getting on the Tebow bandwagon. I'm going to let that one ride on, but I'm going to wait on that Cam Newton bandwagon. You know, the Tebow bandwagon pull up around. Y'all go ahead. I'm waiting on that Cam Newton.
Oh, you know I'm on that Cam now.
Oh, yeah. I had to jump on. I was kind of waiting. I was like, I'm going to let it come around the block a couple more times, see how this goes.
I was on that before the SEC camp.
You were. I gotta give you your props. I want my Eli Alex Smith props. I gotta give you your Cam Newton props.
You gonna get that.
All right, here we go. Speaking of which, number 3 and 5 on the black hand side, San Francisco versus the New York Giants. PAD, who you got and why?
I'm going with San Fran. Simply because they have the home field advantage. And even though we've seen the New York football Giants be successful on the road, I just think with this defense, they're going to give Eli a different look. And Eli has been very patient. He's been very deliberate. And he has not taken unnecessary risks. For 4 straight games now. I've never seen Eli do that for a 5th straight game.
Gotta give.
So,
I feel you.
yet. So at the end of the day, game changer, I know what you think about he and Phillip Rivers, but I think Eli is simply...
They are who we thought they were.
T-A-Z, matter-of-factly. Just matter-of-factly. That's all it is.
That's right.
Hey, I actually agree with you. Like I said, I am not an Eli Manning fan. I think he's better than Phillip Rivers, but I am not an Eli Manning fan. That just says more about what I think about Phillip Rivers than anything. All right? I'm going with San Francisco. I think this playoff is going to come down. You know, the last couple of years has been about offense, offense, offense. I think this year what you're going to see are kind of an old-school look in the Super Bowl. I think, you know, I had picked the Packers and the Ravens. I'm sticking with the Ravens. The Packers, obviously, I can't pick them anymore. And I think it's going to be Ravens 49ers. And I think we're going to get the Harbaughs in the Super Bowl. But what you're going to see is two teams that rely on running games and strong defense. And that hasn't been the trend in the NFL the last couple of years with Super Bowl teams. You know, you had the Packers winning it last year with a defense that was opportunistic. The Saints won it the year before with a defense that was opportunistic. And I think that's what we have now. You know, we have strong, solid defenses. These are not fluke defenses. These are not get turnover defenses. These are line up and shut you down defenses. And that's hard to deal with. The Packers defense was exposed a little bit last week because they didn't get turnovers. They happened to be on the wrong side of the turnovers as a team, and that hurt them. I don't think San Francisco is going to put themselves in harm's way. I don't think they're going to turn the ball over. And, you know, like you said, Eli is due. He is. I mean, he due like a term paper. He's due. Second semester finna start. Get it in. So he's got some turnovers to lay out. And that San Francisco defense is going to do it. So that's where I'm at with that game. I'm picking San Fran as well. I'm on the Alex Smith train. You know, I had one foot on. I don't pretend like I'll be all in with these cats. I lay it down. Eli, I'm not an Eli Manning fan. He better than Phillip Rivers, though. I'm not an Alex Smith fan. But I did say Alex Smith is not as bad as everybody plays him out to be. And if he could be just functional and a game manager, that San Francisco team was going to make some noise. Check the tape. I said it. Check the tape. It's on there. Check the tape. I said that. All right? And voila. I likes to be right. D-Wills, who you got in this game?
As a parent, what you want for your child is just to have a good life. If you're Jack Harbaugh, are you the happiest father in the world with two of your sons just doing what they're doing? What are the Harbaughs going to make it to the Super Bowl?
Game are they going to this week? That's the bigger question.
I think they're going to watch it from home.
That's the one that's going to cause a fight at the dinner table.
They got to do what they did last and just watch it from home. I'm doing this pick right now. I didn't even come in with a preset. I've been debating this one. Coughlin is a road warrior. His teams are there, but there's just something about Jim. Jim has just been defiant from his days in Stanford from 12 months ago. He's just been defiant. He's been doing this stuff. He's been just rubbing people the wrong way, slapping them on the back, doing all kinds of stuff, saying crazy stuff in the – I got to go with those 49ers. I hate to say it. I know the Dean, he's a 49er fan. I know he's going to love it, but I'm going to go with the 49ers. This maybe is where Eli crumbles. I mean, game changers pushed me on Eli's bandwagon, but I got to say I got to get off right now. I got to get off.
You say this is my stop.
Because the way them 49ers are hitting, the way those 49ers are hitting on defense, that set the tone last week. They hit me with them bone crushing kind of hits. They playing. It's going the crowd going to be in there, and Alex Smith is playing. He's balling out. So I'm going to 49ers.
All right. Now on to number four.
We got the New England Patriots against the Baltimore Ravens. Who you got and why? PhD. Phil T, you there? All right.
He dropped into a coma. He dropped into a coma.
Before we go there, I have a follow-up question concerning Alex Smith.
He was pulling up numbers. That's what he was doing. He was pulling up some damn stats.
Data, not data. Data, okay?
Data.
Alex Smith, grad school, baby. You guys, again, going off the dome a little bit. Have the 49ers found their quarterback of the future in Alex Smith, and should they lock him up in a long-term contract?
Yes.
I would say yes. And because Harbaugh's there, I think Harbaugh has developed him. I think Harbaugh he's seen something in him that he likes. He sees something there. I say yes.
Yeah, I say yes. They have the Colin Kaepernick kid from Nevada who they drafted last year in the second round. You got the QB of the future in tow. You let Smith run his course and do what he needs to do for the next couple of years. You lock him up. You do what you need to do with him, and then when Kaepernick is ready, you make a decision. You know, do you keep him? Do you let him go? Do you trade him? What do you do? You decide then. But I think right now you have a guy who is flourishing and playing well in the system with the current coach that you have in place. You ride that out. And, you know, again, this is a guy you took number one for a reason. You thought he had talent. That talent seems to be coming out, and you let that continue to roll. I mean, I don't think it can get any worse. Maybe that's not a good line of thought, but that's how I feel about it. Looks like we got Ray. Is that Ray? I think we got Ray on. I'm gonna jump him on real quick. Hey, Ray, is that you, man?
It's me. What's up?
What's up, partner? How you doing?
Pretty good, pretty good. Long time no hear.
I know, right? Yeah. Yeah, I've been busy. I've been busy, man. Life, coaching, you know.
How the final exams going, Ray?
What's that?
How those final exams going?
Oh, man, they're killing me. That's what I've been undercover. Of the darkness. You can't be old and try to go back to school.
Oh, yeah, it ain't easy. It ain't easy ever going to school. Let alone when you got life and responsibilities and a mortgage, man. I tell you.
Right. You know, it ain't even the same in the lunchroom. You know, we ain't got nothing to talk about. That's too young for me to be hanging out with.
Right.
So we're hitting the Baltimore game?
Yeah, so we at the Baltimore game. We're talking about Baltimore and New England. You know, and before we get to talking about this game again, I got to gloat a little bit. Because, again, at the beginning of the season, we had the whole Flacco versus Sanchez debate. And I took Flacco. Everybody was like, oh, Flacco sucks. Oh, Flacco was terrible, man. Give me Sanchez. Okay. Okay. Anybody want to sell his Sanchez stock?
Hold on. They're not in this situation because of Flacco. Flacco was ducking when nobody was hitting him. Don't tell me they won that game because Flacco was playing.
Flacco hey, where's New York? Is New York not in the playoff because of Sanchez? Hell yeah.
No, New York got a whole bunch of other problems.
And Sanchez is one of them. And Sanchez is one of them.
Flacco up there ducking and dodging. It like he got, like he sees ghosts.
You a Steelers fan, man. Ghosts. You can't give a Raven no props.
John Harbaugh is family.
That's what that is.
John Harbaugh is family. You know I love Ray. You know I love Reed. I love them. Flacco can't give no love, man. He's a trust fund kid, as they said. Did you wait?
Hey, but Flacco in the AFC Championship and Sanchez at the crib getting talked about by his teammates on in all of the New York papers. So who you want, Flacco or Sanchez? I'm taking Flacco. Oh, man, in this game, I think I'm going to take I'm going Baltimore. I'm sticking with those guns. I'm taking B-more. I don't know if Brady and Belichick got it. I think that defense in New England is going to get exposed because they can't stop the run, and I think Ray Rice is going to have his way with them. I don't think there's a whole lot they can do, and I think Baltimore's defense is going to do enough to slow New England's offense down. I mean, New England has a good offense, but Baltimore has a good defense. The Broncos did not, right? The Broncos' defense got a rep, again, off of third-string quarterbacks and fumbling-ass running backs and second-string running backs. And in the playoffs, you don't see that. So I'm not sold on New England. I'm not, you know, everybody's throwing around the whole they didn't beat a team with a winning record all season. I'm not sold on Belichick and Brady in this one.
Well,
so
I will say this, and I'm going to put out on a limb, you know, because I'm not going against – I'm going to go for Baltimore. And the reason why, not because of Flacco, I think that the Ravens because they're going to win this in spite of Flacco. What they're going to do is they're going to disrupt those routes, and they're going to get on those cats, and they're going to make them – play physical. They're going to get all those tight ends, and I think they're going to do what they need to do defensively.
Okay, okay. All right, PhD, man, who you got, New England or Baltimore?
I'm rolling with the Ravens. Rolling with the Ravens. The caveat is they need to get Ray Rice at least 20 to 25 touches. When they go away from Ray Rice, they are a very pedestrian offense. Blame it on Flacco, blame it on the lack of weapons, blame it on the alcohol, whatever it is. Ray Rice, they are a very average team. So I like the Ravens.
Yeah, you know what? I agree. They have no reason to go away from Ray Rice, which is why I think they're going to win this game, because I would take Flacco over Sanchez, but I'm not taking Flacco over anybody else. So I think they don't have any – that's not Aaron Rodgers back there. That's not Drew Brees. That's not even Eli Manning back there. So you get a damn ball to Ray Rice, and you let him do what he do, because anything else would be uncivilized at that moment. So I'm right. That's why I think Baltimore got this. I think Baltimore's got this, and I don't think there's very much that New England has for them.
Okay, and then let me be the dissenting one there. If nobody else wants to play that role, I think all of you are wrong. I think that Tom Brady is the killer. I think that you watch the game. You know, what he did to Denver wasn't unlike what he was doing to people all year. And given that there's only one quarterback left in the whole playoffs, I got to ride with him. Didn't you guys watch the game on Sunday? Didn't the six touchdown mean anything to you? You know, Ray Rice ain't going to run for six touchdowns.
For against Denver's defense? Denver,
that's all they had all year. That's all
but
they
didn't really have. It was smoke and mirrors, man. You got to look at who they were playing. They were playing the Bears with Caleb Haney back there and Marion Barber back there.
But that's the same thing they're talking about. The same thing they're saying about the Ravens.
The Ravens beat the Pittsburgh Steelers twice. They beat the Bengals twice. They beat the 49ers. They played people this year. The Patriots haven't beat anybody with a winning record all season. And their defense is still terrible. haven't played. They didn't play nobody, and their defense sucks.
Terrible.
But I think when you don't fall asleep on Belichick, and you don't fall asleep on Brady, I think it's going to be a good football game, and I think that it's going to be
Ray, don't let Tebow fool you, man. Just because they got Tebow don't mean nothing.
Tebow don't fool me at all. But even if it's not Brady, you know.
Don't let that win against Tebow. Tebow's shitty. They supposed to be something like that.
That's the
team that
didn't
even in the playoffs.
That's the residual effect of that mania.
That team didn't even in the playoffs. You know, don't let them fool you, man. Don't let them. That's that fight in the lunchroom. That's that fight in the lunchroom where the one kid beats up on a loudmouth weakling who really shouldn't have said nothing to begin with, and he whoops his ass, and then everybody in the room like, oh, don't mess with Terry. He'll get you. You see what he did to Ray. He whooped Ray's ass. Man, Ray can't fight. Ray was just talking crazy. You know what I'm saying? That's what Tebow was, man. Tebow was that dude, man. Ray shouldn't have said nothing. Ray stepped out of line because he was trying to impress Sheila. He was trying to show out for Sheila. And Terry stepped up and slapped him in the mouth a couple times. Now everybody thinks Terry tough, and Terry really ain't that tough. He just happened to be fighting Ray.
Now,
that's what that was right there, man.
Now, honestly, I'm guessing Terry and Sheila pop up somewhere in the Game Changers pack.
What was that Wayans movie where he had to fight the midget? He fought the midget?
Yeah.
That's his Sheila.
What was that? I'm going to get you, sucker? Was that what that was?
Yeah. Yeah, he's like, here, hold this. I got to do this.
And that's what Tebow was, man. Tebow was the midget, man. The little person, the dwarf, the elf, man. That's what Tebow was, man. Tebow had no business being in the playoffs. We all know that.
See, everybody talked about Breeze all year and Aaron Rodgers all year, and you know, Tom Brady was throwing the ball like crazy. So I just don't.
But Ray, you see what happened? Where's Breeze at? Where's Breeze at right now?
Sure.
At the crib.
Where's there?
At the crib.
Where's Aaron Rodgers? That's what I'm saying. There's one
quarterback
left.
Where Rodgers at?
There's one quarterback left.
But see, that's the thing, though. All those teams are one-dimensional. Packers can't run the ball. And when they did, they kept fumbling it. The Saints got a good running game, but they don't use it. I see the same thing with the Patriots.
Okay.
Now you need to be able to run the ball. It's cold as hell outside.
That's what
I don't know if you
checked.
We all in the Midwest, man. It's cold as hell outside, man. It ain't time to be throwing the ball all over the yard.
It's a long time.
I think that's what this
weather.
Playoff is about, man. This is what this playoff is about. It's about defense and putting the ball in the hands of a running back, and the Patriots cannot do that.
Well, it's also about being there and having done that. And right now, again, the only quarterback left in this race has been there and done that. The only coach left in this race has been there and done that. They happened to
be. That was
in
like
New
seven,
England.
8 years ago, man.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
The Patriots just won their first playoff game in like 5 years.
Sure.
Nobody talking about that, though.
It ain't like the Ravens been at the dance.
That's true.
This one.
So they even. So nobody's got an advantage. So that's not an advantage. So that experience is not an advantage for New England.
Okay.
I got a lot of sports backed up in me, man.
What I would say, Ray, the point that I would say, though, is that we got to watch with the game is that New England's defense has been playing better down the stretch in the last 5 or 6 games. So they have been improving, have been playing in a way that I didn't really see the Packers' defense necessarily improving down the stretch. So I think that's going to be part of it. Can they take away that run game? Can they be physical? That's going to be a part of it. But the one thing I'm looking at is that one thing I know the Ravens are going to do, they're going to beat the hell out of those tight ends. You remember what I told you about A lot of teams are not very disciplined about hitting those tight ends. Ravens are one of those teams. They hit, they'll bang them and not let them get off the line. And so that's the kind of stuff that disrupts Brady, and they'll put the pressure up the middle. That's the big thing, that the strength of their defensive line, those cats, Nada and all those cats can put that pressure up the middle. And I think that's what's going to cause Brady problems.
New England did not respect Denver. On the first play of the game, they put their damn tight end in the backfield. I think they was making fun of Denver. Like, this is what y'all should be doing with Tebow. That was a sneak diss. That's what that was. That was a shot. That was McDaniels. That was all McDaniels right there. That was McDaniels' play call. He was like, we're going to run a tight end sweep. Get the biggest woman on the team and put him in the backfield and run a sweep. I'm just saying. So let's keep this trucking. Let's get on to number five. So there were three. When I put out the rundown, there were three coaching jobs available. Now there are four. All right? Which coaching job do the real sports guys want? All right, I'm going to throw this one out to D. Wills first. Tampa Bay, Oakland, Miami, or Indy? Which one you want?
Woo! I would say Oakland. I think they got McKenzie there with a good GM. I think they got good bones in terms of running game that they can pull together. Defense is strong. I think they got some good pieces there, and I think they're in a division that's winnable. So Oakland's a team that I think I would want.
Hey Ray, which one are you taking?
I think that I would go perhaps Oakland. If I'm going to try to win right away, that's the team I want. I don't want to have to work that hard. I think Indianapolis, you figure if you take a bad team like that, you got like 3 years. After 3 years, they start looking at you like you either do it or you don't, And there's a lot to be said about New England, or not New England, but Indianapolis. If Manny comes back, they're a different ball team. And if they have a new quarterback, a young quarterback, you got built-in controversy and everything else starting. So, I'm all about trying to get in there and win some ball games. I'm trying to be a coach.
See, I want to keep my job.
Right.
I want to keep getting these checks.
And you got Tommy Boy owner, he don't know nothing about football anyway, so you can do what you
right.
want.
Right.
I'm looking, honestly, I think all these are desirable jobs. If I had to pick one, it'd be Tampa Bay. I think they've got enough young talent down there. Honestly, I think they'd let go of Morris a little bit too soon. I think Tampa Bay, Oakland, Miami, and now Indianapolis, all these jobs are better than the jobs that became available last year. Harbaugh had his pick between Miami and the 49ers, and I think all four of these teams, Miami's still in the mix, but all four of these teams are more desirable destinations. And honestly, I wouldn't be surprised if one of these four cities, franchises, pull out one of these high, high-profile coaches, such as a Bill Cowher, such as a John Gruden, guys that have just kind of been sitting, saying, hey, I'm cool with my career here unless I get the perfect opportunity that comes. And, if I'm John Gruden, I got a chance to either coach A, Peyton Manning, B, Andrew Luck, or C, both. Especially
right.
in an environment where it's going to be, kind of like Ray said, hey, they're going to be patient.
you're going to be the new guy that the new GM is bringing in. You're going to be his guy. So you're going to get a 3 to 5 year window, I'd imagine, to turn things around.
Okay.
I mean, that's almost that's almost a win-win situation when you talk about, you know, trying to win right away. You know, having, you know, either Peyton Manning's going to come back or you're going to have Luck, you know. So, I mean, it's like of all the teams that are out there with situations that you aren't going to overcome, you know, quarterback, if you get the quarterback piece going, I mean, that's – because there's some teams out there that just, you know, are going to be hurting for a long time because they just don't have a quarterback. Denver is going to be hurting for a long time because they aren't going to make up their mind about what they're going to do with this quarterback situation. You know, at least at Indianapolis, you're going to come out with a damn good quarterback on opening day.
And honestly, I don't know what the debate is, man. After thinking about this, I know I said before that you keep Peyton Manning and you try and trade those picks. Really, I don't know what the debate is. You know, tell me when this hasn't worked. When you really think about it, when hasn't that worked? Where you have a guy in place and you draft a guy who has a ton of talent in the first round and you let him sit behind him. When hasn't that worked?
It's worked every time, just about.
I'll wait.
Yeah, I'm with you.
And that's it. I mean, of all the headaches a new coach is going to have, it's generally always about who's going to start at quarterback. Even Harbaugh in San Francisco had issues. Nobody knew that Alex Smith was going to start this year. I mean, it happened for him. It wasn't, or perhaps he did. You know, perhaps he did have a lot to do with, you know, getting Smith to play better. But it wasn't something that was guaranteed. At least in Indianapolis, you guaranteed to have a damn good quarterback.
Right. Right. So, yeah, I dig that. I agree. The job that I probably would want right away if I was a coach would be Oakland because, again, you know, I think that's why Harbaugh went to San Francisco. He looked at the rest of that division and said, I'll take that one. You know, I think I look at Oakland the same way. I look at the rest of the division and I say, yeah, give me that one. Let me give that a try for a minute. When you're looking at Tampa and you got to go against Atlanta every year, you got to go against New Orleans every year, and Cam Newton and Carolina getting their act together, I'll pass. And then you go to Miami, and, you know, you got Belichick and Brady who are good every year. Again, that may be a little bit more desirable, but I'll take my chances with Tebow and Phillip Rivers and whoever the hell Kansas City wants to play a quarterback. You know, but outside of Oakland, a job that I think I would want would be either be Indy or Miami. I don't want to touch that Tampa Bay gig. That's a real young team in an up-and-coming division. They got pieces there. Can they get those pieces to play again the way they played that last year? Was it the schedule that was too tough? I mean, they had a gauntlet of a schedule, and I think Raheem Morris just lost that team. At some point, when you lose 10 straight, it's the NFL. Losing 10 straight is just as hard as winning 10 straight in the NFL. At some point, it's got to click. And when it just doesn't click, you ain't trying. Somebody's not putting forth the effort. That's an effort thing. When you go that long without a victory, it becomes an effort thing. It becomes a culture thing, and they had to make a change. I don't know if I want to jump into that. In Miami, I think if they can get a quarterback in that situation, they could be all right. Go ahead.
You know that whole thing in Indianapolis, you know, with you know, Manning being gone for the year, and, you know, I'm a big Jim Caldwell fan, of course, being from Beloit, and you almost felt sorry for him, you know, realizing that some of those personnel changes and moves, you know, really weren't on him. You know, they just say, here's the team you have, go out there, win as many as you can, and they came up way short, you know, way short of expectation. You know, and I just, you know, you wonder I think Caldwell is a good coach, and I just wonder where he may land on his feet, you know, and where
I agree. Caldwell is definitely a good coach.
He's too much of a football mind to – he's not going to be a commentator, you know. I don't see him as a commentator. And I think that there's a reason to fear, you know, Jimmy Caldwell on the sideline, either as offensive coordinator or defensive coordinator or head coach somewhere else. You know, that's the beauty of a Caldwell is that, you know, he was a linebacker as a player and then a quarterback coach and then, you know, and then the head coach at Indianapolis. So I'm anxious to see where he ends up and how well, especially when you have a situation, if Green Bay should lose their defensive coordinator, you know, I would love to see an opportunity for Caldwell to come up there and fly his wares there. Because I see definite needs and changes in defense up in Green Bay, and I'm anxious to see where he lands on his feet.
Yeah, I think you know it was really surprising with how things went down in Indianapolis. That coach team, you think about the pieces. You know, when you started the season, you thought, okay, they're going to struggle a little bit, but when you're talking about a Reggie Wayne, an Austin Colley, a Dallas Clark on offense, plus a Joseph Addai and a Donald Brown, you expected more out of that offense. Even the defense, you know, it's not the greatest defense in the world, but it was a functional defense. Well, it wasn't functional this season. You know, when you think about some of the names that they have on that defense, it just wasn't good. And no part of that team was very good. And you really saw how much Peyton Manning meant to that squad.
Well, that's the same, and you look at the same situation with the Chicago Bears. You know, if you look at how badly they played after Cutler went out, you know, Indianapolis faced that from the opening week. So, I mean, it was, you know, who's really to blame? Did Lovie Smith coach the Bears so much better than Jimmy Caldwell coached the Colts that he still has his job?
Well, I think we heard Caldwell's what happened in Houston. So, I mean, they lost the first and second string quarterback, I mean, and kept winning. So, I think they saw Denver. So, I think some other situations were hurt him. And also,
I think it was
a change in regime.
But there again, is that Caldwell's fault? You know,
When you lose 12 straight games, your job is in jeopardy.
But again, the general manager had to leave first. The general manager had to leave first. Because when you look down the bench and the quarterback you got, you know, the quarterbacks that you have to put out there aren't going to play well enough to win games. You know, I realize that that's
But you used to have Reggie Wayne playing. You had all those cats on defense. What happened to all them?
Sure. Sure.
They got to play.
You also had Reggie Williams.
They all got a check.
Yeah.
So they all got to get up and play. And so you have Mathis. You got too many good guys on defense for you just to be taking it like you're taking it. So, you know, and Reggie Wayne, you mean to tell me they still can't catch the ball? Dallas Clark, all these cats that they had. I mean, I know they got hit with injuries, but they still had that talent going in and out. So what was going on? What was the change in the game plan? Were there any kind of adjustments in terms of how style you play? You saw Denver change their style, right? So why did you change your style? I just say you just can't lose 12 straight games. You in trouble. You got to know that. One foot off the table.
Oh, no, he's out.
I mean, unfortunately, it's probably a death knell for him. Again, I don't know what that means for Peyton. The GM is gone. The executive team is gone at the Polians. His coach is gone. I mean, I hope they keep him because it makes sense. Again, when has it not worked? Keep him. See if he can play. It's a hefty price, but hell, again, when has it not worked? Go ahead and get the luck, kid, and see what you can do. It's a win-win either way. You know, if Peyton can't play, you cut him and you cut your losses and you move on or you trade him or you do what you need to do. So, you know, that's that. That's the five on the black-hand side. Now, we're going to transition into field tees, 10 through 6, NBA top 50. PhD,
uh-oh.
Run them down.
Uh-oh.
Well, first of all, I apologize
to the live listeners, you guys have to carry us on over to the after hour portion of the show and download the show to hear my 6 through 10. Because trust me, it is must see TV, must listen to radio. So at number 10, I'm coming in with Timmy Duncan. At number 9, I'm bringing the Black Mamba, Kobe Bryant. At 8, this may be a surprise to some, I've got Larry Bird. At 7, I've got the Dream, Hakeem, you call it, the Dream, Olajuwon. At 6, a bit of a surprise, I'm coming with Moses Malone at number 6. My top 6 through 10, Timmy Duncan at 10, Kobe Bryant at 9, Larry Bird at 8, Olajuwon at 7, and Moses Malone at 6. I'm open for business.
I think we're in the after hour, so we might have to swear on that one. Moses Malone. This is what I love. This is the struggle, Phil T, because both you and Marcus, you know, I was a Philly fan. So I was, when he said fo-fo-fo, I watched Good Morning America after they won a championship. I didn't want to go to school, man. I was so hyped. Billy Cunningham, Andrew Tony, Bibby. I mean, I love and watching him play with Houston. So how did you get him at 6? I mean, you young cats are killing me. I'm loving this. How did you put him at 6? Talk to me about Moses, man.
Well, Moses Malone, first of all, for those who don't know, he was really the modern guy to first straight from high school to the pros. You know, we think about what KG did in 95, but really Moses did that 20 years prior. Let me run off some of his numbers. Finals MVP in 83. NBA MVP 3 times, 79, 82, 83. He's a first team All-NBA 7 times. He's an All-NBA team. He's one of the greatest 50 players. This is a guy who stood 6'10". Moses, you know, anywhere from a solid 215 as a youngin to about 280 as an old cat. Let me share some of his numbers. 31-15 in 81 with Houston. Okay. 27-14. This guy's one of the best passers in the post that you've ever seen. And in my opinion, he didn't get enough credit for that. Some people call him the black hole at times. But if you look at Moses, Moses fine.
Yeah, he would keep that rock now. He wasn't Kevin McHale with it.
Moses was a beast on the offensive boards. Okay?
Right.
On a per-game record, I mean, on a per-game basis, only guys such as Russell, Rodman, have a higher per-game offensive rebound mark. And oftentimes, that generated a lot of his offense. The reason I put Malone so high is because he was dominating for such a long period of time. You look at 77, all the way to his days in Milwaukee, he was a force to be, somebody that had to deal with him. Moses was a guy who could put a team on his back. And, you know, I really struggled with, Olajuwon, Bill Russell, trying to figure out if they playing different eras. And, you know, Olajuwon's a no-brainer, Malone as well. And Malone's a guy I think that could dominate in today's game. When you look at his game when he was younger, he was extremely athletic. So that's why I'm going Moses at 6.
Okay. I can't argue with you, man.
You present
a sound argument for Moses at 6.
Moses was a dominant center in an era of quite a few dominant centers, and that's
right.
You know, he played unlike a Walton and maybe a Russell, where they always argue about, you know, who did they ever play against for the talent that they had, you know, and it's one of those things. But Moses was, he was battling centers that were centers, you know. He was putting his skills up against Jabbar. He was putting up his skills against Olajuwon. He was putting his skills up against Parrish. You know, he was a dominating center in an era that had a lot of good dominating centers.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I've got, in my top 13, I have 7 centers. And let's check off the amount, the number of these 7 centers that Moses played and played well against. David Robinson, check. Shaq, check. Tim Duncan, no. Olajuwon, check. Bill Russell, no. Kareem, check. Will, I think Will's last season was right around when Moses started in the ABA, so they didn't really play together or play against each other.
Yeah, I can't argue that, man. You know, that's my guy. You hit me. Y'all hit me with 2 of my Philly greats. I'm like, I can't even mess with y'all. I can't even argue. Y'all don't hit my – you done went right after the heartstrings on a brother. You got me getting emotional over here in the corner. I'm like, I want to cry a little bit. You know I love Moses. You make me feel guilty why I didn't have Matt 6.
So here's what I'm going to have to throw at you, D. I'm going to have to throw at you, D. Newell, PhD. PhD, Kobe at 9. Kobe's the top 10 player all time?
Yes. And I think you can make a debate that wherever Mike is at, he needs to be very close to that. So if I've got Mike at 1, if I've got Mike at 3, Kobe should be in the same neighborhood. Because let's take a step back from perception, let's take a step back from brand, let's take a step back in this argument of who was first. Let's match numbers, let's match accomplishments, let's match dominating presence. And yes, Jordan is certainly ahead of Kobe, but when you're looking at perimeter players, I can't think of many that are between Kobe and Mike. On my list, I've only got 2. I mean, the guy's won 5 championships.
I can't argue with me.
And one could argue, well, you know, he wasn't the best player on the first 3 of those. Maybe not. Magic Johnson's higher on my list, and an argument could be made that he wasn't the best player on many of his championship teams. An argument could be made. Not one that I would support, but one could be made.
Well, I have nothing to say because I have to roll out my list. So I will not say anything on that, but I will make my point soon.
Okay. It just don't feel right. I can't really argue with your logic, man. It just don't feel right to me, man.
Yeah.
Game changer. You treating Kobe like you say I'm treating the Ravens. it's like he stole your lunch money and don't nobody know that. You got something against him. Y'all was at a party together and y'all looked at each other.
I got him at 13, man. I got him at 13, and for the most part, other than a couple cats, there really isn't anybody who I have ahead of Kobe that you guys might have at least in the same neighborhood as Kobe.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I would say maybe I think Jerry West is a bit higher on my list than he is on at least Phil's as far as his relationship to Kobe. But other than that, I mean, we kind of got most of the same guys in the same area. I don't know, man.
man.
I'm a Kobe Bryant hater. I'll go ahead in a minute. I'm a Kobe hater.
And I was for a long time, man. I was for a long time. But Kobe, he has not changed since the way he came in 18. He took the last shot in Utah. He stood tall when other grown men were shrinking. He's the only person I could – he shot the best game in the air ball I've ever seen with confidence and walked off. Like what? Like what? Like, head went down. He was like, what? I'll shoot it again. Give me the ball. That right there told me something about that young man. And he has not stopped trying to be a killer from day one.
Yeah, I can't argue, as much as it don't feel right, I can't really argue it. I can't.
You know, Olajuwon was a very tough guy for me to place. You know, Marcus, you had him at 10, I had him at 7, and honestly, he and Moses kind of flip-flop. You know, as a teaser for next week, I have Bill Russell at 5. I actually considered putting Dream and Malone ahead of Bill Russell, but I didn't want no trouble. Okay.
I didn't want to get shot in the joint.
You could have now. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. So, D. Wills, what you got on your list?
All right, fellas. I'm gonna walk the dog. At 10. I got Jerry West. You know, he was a 12-time NBA All-Star. He first or second team. He's 14 times altogether. He was the MVP in 72. He holds the highest points per game average in the playoff series, 46.3. Had mad skills. He made 4 all defensive teams after the age of 32. I mean, this cat is just an all-around player. He's the logo. I mean, we don't have to argue about it. I think we all have, but I have him at 10. At 9, the guy that we've been talking about, Kobe Bean Bryant, the Black Mamba. Basically, what, 5 NBA championships, 2-time NBA Finals MVP, NBA Most Valuable Player, 13-time NBA All-Star. He was 2-time NBA scoring champ. He's been first-team All-Star 9 times. He's been 9 times All-Defensive Player. You know, first-team, he was 2-time All-Defensive Player, second-team. You know, 4-time NBA All-Star MVP. He has 5 60-point games. He has 24 50-point games. I think right now he has 110 40-point games. I think he's put the package together, and then he has the 81-point game that only makes him second to, you know, the man, the big man. Tim Duncan, the big fundamental. This cat, 4-time NBA champion, 3-time NBA finals guy. I mean, this guy has been on – he was 13 years on all NBA team, his first 13 years. Can do it all, probably the most complete power forward in my mind in history, but just outstanding kind of player. And then we got Larry Bird, Larry Legend. You know, 3-time NBA champion. 12-time NBA All-Star, 2-time NBA Finals MVP, 3-time NBA Most Valuable Player, helped to change the game along with Magic in terms of bringing the game, the modern game that we know. He was 3-time All-NBA defensive second team. Bird is my guy. Bill Russell at 6. You got 11 championships, 5-time NBA Most Valuable Player. He had 5 NBA rebounding championships. He had, 12 NBA All-Star games he's played in. Just, you know, dominant player, ultimate winner. I had him at 6. So that's my 10 through 6.
Man, that's sound, man. I can't really even poke a hole in that, man. We'd already talked about Kobe Bean. Gary West, he's about where I had him. Bill Russell's in that same tier with me. Larry, you guys had Larry lower than me. I got Larry in my top 5. Wow, pontificate on that for a moment.
Well, my top 5 is a combination of winners like Larry, dominating players. I mean, when I talk about my top 5, they have such a presence that it was hard for me to move Larry Bird into as much as I, and Larry Bird, I'm a Pistons fan, so Celtics, Lakers, a lot of these cats I'm going to be talking about, I rooted against them. But I had to pull my real sports guys out. I had to analyze. And Bird was a hard person for me to talk about because of the battles that the Celtics and the Pistons had. But when I talk about my top 5, I think what separated them, and it was, you know, you're talking about very little, but these people in the top 5 were iconic in a way that Bird was, one like Bird, but just had something else that made them it. And that's all that I can say.
Good point. Devon, I got a question for you concerning Bill Russell.
Mm-hmm.
Marcus had Bill Russell at 8. You had him at 6. As I mentioned as a teaser for next week, I have him at 5. I really struggled where to place Bill because he played in a different era than most of the guys in my top 10 and top 15. What are your thoughts on what Bill could do in today's game and if that entered into where you placed him?
Well, I think Bill could play in today's game and play well. And one of the things, if we go back to, you know, even Damon Williams' comments about what's different about players today versus the 80s, Bill has the ability, and I think y'all appreciate it. One of the things we say about great point guards, and the reason why we like people like Jason Kidd, is you can control a game without scoring, right? That's where you really, I mean, some of the elite people. And one of the things that Russell, I think, did very well is that he had the ability to control a game without scoring. And then also his leadership. I mean, part of winning the championships, I mean, he had a lot of – you don't win championships without having a lot of great players around you. But I think there was no greater leader probably in basketball history other than a couple people we're going to have here in the top 5 than Bill Russell. He got every ounce that he could out of his ability. And I think that is probably one of the most important things, I think, is in terms of being one of these lead players, that he got every ounce. He left nothing on the table. And I think his abilities, I think he would do well in this game. He wouldn't be a great – he probably wouldn't be a great scorer, but his ability to think the game, defend in the post, run the floor – get after the ball. I mean, in some ways, I think that his game could come. He probably would have had a little bit more of an offensive game. You know, it's not that he couldn't score, but I just think that he had the combination that you need to be a champion leader. I think he had it all. And I didn't get a chance to see him play a lot, but I watched a lot of tape. He's a person that I spent a lot of time watching because I really like studying people who figure out how to win at the highest level.
One of the things I struggle with Bill is the majority of the time he played in the NBA had less than 12 teams. In fact, his first 5 championships, the NBA only consisted of 8 teams.
I mean, I look at that, and that's a product of the time, but that's not a product of the player. So there's certain people you can look at and know, yeah, there were 16, 18s, but he still would have been good with 12, 15, whatever. I mean, I think that for him, he's the kind of person that transcends that I would say. That didn't hold me back as much, that they had fewer teams, which means it meant that it was tough every night. You didn't have a night off either. So you can look at it another way. You can say, look, talent was compacted, and you didn't have a night off, any. You couldn't take a night off. You can't take a night off in Sacramento. You had to play tough every night. That's another way to look at having a smaller number of teams.
I think anytime you look at these eras and you look at these players from old times and wonder how well they would have done, and I think that you always have to remember that the same dedication it took for them to play at that level at that time would carry over to whatever advantage they may have during these times. You know, you got to remember, you know, they hopped on buses and drove to wherever they were going. They didn't have the nutrition. They didn't have all of the things that these players today have. When you talk about, you know, these sportsmen from eras ago, you know, how would Ali have done against Tyson? Well, the same dedication that Ali put into being a champion during his time would tell me that, given, you know, the advantages that Tyson might have or a champion today might have, you know, given proper nutrition and you know, facilities and coaching and technology, all of these things, if Russell would have the opportunity to grow up, you know, today, he would probably be the same dominating player, because that's generally what it takes to be an elite athlete, is that dedication to, you know, honing your craft. And at the time, Russell honed his craft better than anybody else. At his time, Wilt Chamberlain honed his craft better than anybody else. So, you know, when you compare these players of old with you know, these new players, you know, Kobe Bryant is the elite player that he is because he has the dedication, and he gets out there and he's shooting practice shots. You know, there's nobody on the Lakers that has shot more shots than Kobe Bryant. You know, there's nobody that has gone to the gym more often than Kobe Bryant. You know, that's what made Kobe Bryant who he is. That's what made Bill Russell who he is. And, you know, when you start to compare these eras, just always remember that, you know, these players were at the top of their game because they put more into their game than anybody else around them. So how would they fare today? They would probably fare about the same. They would probably have, you know, the same skill set and be able to perform and produce, you know, at least close to what they were doing back then, or at least as close as to what the elite players are doing today.
Yeah, I think for Russell, to me, his most kind of elite level skill was that leadership and, like you said, that dedication to being the best basketball player he could be. And I think that's a skill set that translates across eras. I don't think that's one that is era specific. I think that's one that you definitely would translate today. You know, Devon talked about his being able to control a game without scoring. I think I think he's probably the prototype kind of guy. When you look at a Jason Kidd, when you look at, you know, a Dennis Rodman, that's the patient zero, so to speak, of that kind of a archetype of player.
There you go, baby.
That's that guy that all of those guys are derived from. Even when you look at a guy like Rondo, a guy who can impact the game without scoring a whole lot of points off of the things he does defensively and the way he sets up his teammates, that's what you get with Russell. And I think Russell was is the pinnacle of that thus far that we've seen of a guy who can do that.
And the thing about Russell that I'll always remember is Bill Russell, the shot blocker. I mean, the things that Bill Russell had to basically teach himself. He taught every other shot blocker that followed, you know, the timing, the baiting. You know, how many times did you watch films of Bill Russell where he let that guy take that next step, knowing that he was going to come behind and sweep the ball from behind, you know, without making that foul? that's what made, you know, to me, that's what makes a guy like Bill Russell so great. Nobody was there to teach Bill Russell how to block shots, you know.
Right, he didn't get to watch Bill Russell.
That's right. You know, he learned the footwork necessary. He learned how to anticipate. He learned how to, you know, and he taught everybody else. He made it an art form.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you have a guy who coaches will say, go watch tape of this guy to learn how to do a skill, that's a guy that's got to be kind of up there on your list.
Yep.
He's got to be in there on your list. And, you know, as far as rebounding, playing post defense, blocking shots, Bill Russell is one of those guys that a coach will say, go watch the tape of Bill Russell. You want to learn how to rebound. You want to learn how to block shots. You want to watch somebody
right.
do it the right way. Go watch the tape
right.
of Bill Russell.
That's right.
You know, that's in the same way somebody may say, go watch the tape of Larry Bird when you talk about shooting. When you talk about consistency of form. When you talk about, you know, release point. When you talk about footwork. And getting your base underneath you when you shoot the basketball. Larry Bird is one of those guys, you know. So, yeah.
Ray, could you talk a little bit about Russell's offensive game or even Devon? I know you mentioned you saw a lot of tape, Devon. His offensive game, you know, I'm just not clear in terms of, was he a post player? Did he have a mid-range game? Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, let me just start to say that I remember when I was in junior high, and they were teaching the big men a drop step, you know, and that was the typical, you know, where you hook that leg, whether you're going right or left. If you can get that leg to the inside, you got that man beat, and that's exactly the way that Russell would do it. You got to remember that he also played in an area where they weren't doing a lot of behind-the-back passes. They weren't doing a lot of fancy things. It was pretty robotic. And if you could do it, and if you had the speed to do it, it was automatic. You had your man beat. If you had your back to the basket and you hooked that leg around and got inside of that other fellow's leg, all you had to do was turn, because he could not block your shot without fouling you. And that was Bill Russell. You know,
Ray, when you describe that, all I can think about is a black and white video with some cats with some
sure.
high socks and some pro kids on or some cops.
Yeah.
I love the way you said that. I got it. But you're right. And the other thing he did was he could run the floor in a way that you saw like David Robinson run the floor.
Sure.
Russell could run the floor, too. And he also... Again, you didn't have to run plays for him because he would score, rebound, and put it back up. So it
sure.
wasn't – I think the thing about Russell is he gave you what you needed to win.
Right.
When you judge Russell, is what do we need to win tonight? Well, I'm going to get 18 and 17 rebounds because that's what we need to win tonight. Tomorrow night, I might get 14 and 23 rebounds because that's what
right.
we need to do to win tonight. So – When you look at what Russell gave, even on the offensive end, he gave what they needed to win that night. That's what he gave you. So he could do it around on the post. He could get up and down the court. The fact that he was rebounding champ, he knew where the ball was going to go. You know, he had guards like Cousy could get it to him. So I think he could do a little bit of everything offensively that he needed to do, but what he gave you is what you needed to win for that night. That's when I look at Russell, that's what you got. And so that's the kind of performer he was, whether it was offensively or defensively.
You know, one of the most, and I mean, you guys just nailed that question I have. I have a much better idea. You know, one of the most impressive stats that I ever saw about Russell was something similar I saw about Joe Dumars. In the playoffs, Michael Jordan's not playoffs, but every time he played against Joe DeMars, his overall points per game were about 7.5 to 8 points lower when he was guarded by DeMars. Call it the Pistons, call it team defense, whatever it is, but that speaks to Joe DeMars' greatness. I saw a statistic that Wilt Chamberlain's average was 11 or 12 points less per night when he went up against Russell. And to me, that just spoke volumes because just what a beast offensively what Chamberlain was, and to see that Russell could contain this guy. And, I mean, if the top scorer is getting 11, 12 points less per night, you got a good chance of beating.
That's right.
Well, that's testament to the fact that he brought, you know, his A game when he played, you know, Chamberlain as well. You know, I'd love to see what the statistic would be is how many fewer rebounds did Chamberlain get? You know, how many times did Chamberlain get his shot blocked? Because Chamberlain wasn't used to getting his shot blocked at all, you know. Now all of a sudden here's a guy that
And Wilt wasn't getting used to tell no period.
No. I mean, those are, you know, that's just scoring, you know. I would be anxious to see how his overall numbers looked against Russell. And I would also like to see if Russell's numbers didn't go up a tick, you know. Oh, we're playing Chamberlain tonight. I need about 4 more points. I need about 6 more rebounds if we're going to beat these guys. I got to play that much better. You know, I would love to see if they have a statistic for that.
This has been good. We're going to be getting that top five. That's going to be woo.
Yeah, top five next week. We're going to pick it up there, and we're going to keep it rolling. You know, we'll hold over some of the other topics that we got. It's getting kind of late. I know we all got gigs. I know I got to get up early. You know, some things to think about, man. That Dwight Howard conversation, man. I'm gonna have to go out that on Facebook or something, man. I'm gonna have to put out a little blog on that because Van Pelton was killing me today, man. It was making it seem like you gotta take Dwight Howard if I just don't think you do. Not if you gotta give up Blake Griffin. I don't think you do. I don't think you have to. What does Blake Griffin do? What does Dwight Howard do that Blake Griffin doesn't at this point?
Dwight is taller.
Dwight is an inch taller.
Yeah, but he feel like he's 3 feet taller.
I mean, he's a better defender. He's a better defender, right? I get that. But the Clippers have DeAndre Jordan.
Yeah.
But the Clippers have DeAndre Jordan, who I think is just as good of a rim protector as Dwight is.
Well,
that's my thing, is that offensively, and y'all know how I feel about Dwight. He made some progress last year, but offensively, he's still barely a 20-point guy. And I think, you know, Blake in his first season averaged damn near 23 points a game.
Uh-huh. Blake in his first season sat out, didn't he, when he hurt?
I'm talking about last year's first season of playing.
I'm just saying, you know. I don't buy a Dennis Buick. You know, he might be younger, but I can't forgive a man for missing a whole season.
And the other piece is I don't buy Dwight Howard as I don't buy him as a franchise changer. Orlando's been good.
No.
Orlando's been solid, but they haven't ever scared me. I've never been like, damn, Orlando's gonna do it, and it's because of Dwight.
You know, I wouldn't make a move like that if you know, not with the talent that I already have on my team. That's not giving me that much of an edge, and I'm looking in other directions. I'm filling other holes. I would say, okay, I'm good with Blake, you know.
Yeah.
I'll run with this, you know. If I'm going to fill other holes. That's what I'm going to do. But to just move, just to go up a notch, you know,
yeah.
or to think that you're going up a notch, I don't really think that you are. It isn't.
And Van Pelt and Russillo's whole argument was that Blake was the Dwight Howard was the best center in the league. And I wanted to call in and be like, okay, can you tell me when it matters to be the best center in the NBA? It hasn't mattered to be the best center in the NBA since, like, 2003. Because ain't no centers in the league.
Right.
If you could walk and chew gum, you could be the best center in the league right now.
That's right. $7 million.
If Dwight Howard was playing with Akeem and a young Shaq and David Robinson and Pat Ewing back in them days, he would be the fifth or sixth guy. He would
right.
be hard-pressed to make an all-star team if he played in that era. I mean, he'd be Dale Davis with more hops in that era. Yeah, and that's my thing, is that they were making it seem like Dwight Howard is this game-changing player. Dwight Howard is the best center in the league. He's the only freaking real center in the league. He should be getting about 25 to 27 points a night, plus the 15 rebounds that he gives you. But he's not. And when all those guys went away, when David Robinson started to wane and Akeem started to wane and Ewan started to wane, Shaq became a beast because couldn't nobody do nothing with him. That's
right.
That's not what Dwight Howard is. Dwight Howard has played pretty much his entire career without another legitimate rival in the post. And he ain't really done nothing. So that just burnt me up, because it's like, tell me when it matters to be the best. Tell me when the last time it mattered to be the best center in the league, and when that meant something as far as winning championships. You have to go back to Shaq.
If I'm Dwight Howard, I'm staying in Orlando throughout the season.
You have to.
And just go on a free agency. Go on a free agency this summer and figure out what you want to do then, because
just don't do a special.
I mean, you have limited options.
Don't
you have limited options to choose from. And, you know, I mean, forget about this trying to help out Orlando. You want to try to help them out, do a sign and trade or something. But my thing is you make a move right now with the potential suitors, all you're doing is trading a team that doesn't have enough supporting talent around you to
right.
get the one that's going to strip itself.
Right.
It's kind of like the Clipper deal.
You know,
just wait this summer and do free agency.
Yeah. Unless Orlando finds some sucker that's gonna give up the farm for you, I just sit tight and wait it out, man. I say I'm not signing with anybody after the end of the season. And then you go where you want to go.
That's right.
That's what I do.
Right, he can have a decision show.
Don't do that, though.
Don't do that.
That didn't work
don't
out so well. Some things you look back in history, they work. Having two quarterbacks, two really good quarterbacks, Montana Young, Barb Rogers, that works. Decisions, shows about making free agent decisions, that doesn't work. That didn't work.
In fact, I wouldn't even announce it. What I do is just call LeBron and ask him to tell everybody where I'm going.
Right.
Everybody,
hey, LeBron, I want you to do me a favor.
Yeah.
I want you
to
go on ESPN and tell him where I'm going to take my talents to.
We already don't like you, shit. You better bad news, hell.
They already hate you. They don't need to hate both of us.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, fellas, I'm going to let y'all go, man. It's been a great show. Glad to be back in the fold.
That's right.
We're going to keep this rolling next week.
Marcus, I'm going to be sending the check out in the mail before the week is out. I finally got everybody to pay up.
All right, Fresh. Cool.
Let you know that.
Cool. Get that undefeated season money.
That's right.
Hey, next year I'm naming my team the Mercury Morrises.
The Larry Zonka.
Oh man, yeah, buddy. I that, man, that was pretty unbelievable, man. I couldn't believe that happened.
Yeah.
It went down
like
that, man.
I'm sitting next to you in the draft next year.
He didn't help Devon,
The Chiefs didn't help me.
I still walked away with a title, so that's all I'm going to do. I got mine. I came back like the St. Louis Cardinals on a had to get one of them.
You kind of like the Chicago Cubs. It might be 100 years before you get that again.
All right, you had a drop. Don't call me out now. I'm coming back to win. I'm gonna sweep it all.
See, I proved it can be done this year. It can be done. Going undefeated in fantasy football can be done.
Hell,
Tebow won six straight. Well, all right, fellas. Right, y'all be good. Y'all take care, man. I'll catch y'all next week. All right, take care.